Interim Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Today is Wednesday, January 18th, and I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session for the purpose of introduction of committee legislative concepts. And do I do them each at a time?
I think you just do public hearing one at a time, then you can do them all in one.
Okay. So I'm going to open a public hearing on LC 31, and we have on this one two speakers, Sean Miller and Katie Gobe, to come tell us what this one's all about. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning, co-chairs.
Yep.
Happy New Year. Members of the committee, I'm Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. And first, I want to apologize for the size of the LC draft. The concept that we agreed to is simple, but the statutory construct appears complicated, so we'll discuss that today.
More paper.
But I want to talk a little bit about the history. We are supportive of LC 31, which originally was the Department of Agriculture Food Safety Division's bill last session. It ended up not passing, and it's because during the budget process, and I'll let Katie allude to this, but since there wasn't going to have to be any fee adjustments for the next few years in their forecast, there was actually no need for the bill. However, we do see a need for the bill in the future to preserve the food safety program, which is an important program, public safety program in the state of Oregon. In 2005, the industry and the Department of Agriculture essentially rewrote the statute on food safety fees. During that time, the industry had built up a reserve principal fund in that account that was a stable account. There hadn't been a fee increase for many, many years. And during that time period, the legislature shockingly took that reserve fund. And that was about $4.2 million at the time. And when that occurred, following, and those were during the 2002-2003 time frame during those special sessions. In 2005, because of that, the industry was facing, by rule, upwards of over 100% fee increase to keep the program stable as is. No growth in the program, but just to keep the program. So we were facing either a dramatic cut in the program, which actually would have been a detriment to the public on food safety, or the industry would have to face over 100% increase. So, which, as you can well imagine, was not acceptable to the industry. During that time period, we worked with the legislature and the governor's office to come forward, and I want to note that at the time, because of that, the governor's office submitted a proposed budget that included a 95% fee increase, so still unacceptable to the industry. We worked real hard that time period to come up with a proposal that the industry could support, and we ended up accepting a 31% fee increase. So again, a pretty good fee increase to keep the program alive at the time. But we all said at the time we did not want to go through that again. We don't want to go through a period where either we build up a reserve, it's taken by the legislature, we have to then adjust the fees way up to compensate for that. So what we did is we worked with the agency to make sure that in the fee structure we're going to keep it it's accountable to what's needed, and we did not want to face an increase. And so we actually built into the proposal at that time a 2% fee increase for the next 5 years, statutory. So it was just, again, it was a very small fee increase to the industry that we accepted to keep the program going and hopefully not have the money rated again. Well, in fact, there was some sweeps of some of those funds that were smaller at the time, but because we built in a required 2% fee increase, we said, well, we don't quite want to do that again. And so we agreed with the agency, and this is getting to the LC draft, because that whole program sunsetted prior to, you know, last biennium, we need to address this issue again. And so that what you see before you in LC 31, instead of allowing the agency to do, or just to do an automatic 2% increase, what we've agreed to is allow them to do up to a 3% increase for the next 5 years, but only if it's needed. So again, if it's not needed, which, you know, I'll let Katie talk about this, there will not be a fee increase, but then, you know, if it's a 1% fee increase or 2%, but they cannot go above 3%. And again, that whole idea is to keep the fund whole, to, you know, keep the program as is, make sure that we don't have to face large fee increases and we don't end up with too large of a reserve, because obviously that's something that the industry's put in, and we want to, you know, if it's taken again, then we're facing this whole same scenario again. And so we're trying to avoid that again. So the bill before you allows for those fee increases by rule only for the next 5 years. After the fifth year, that fee will freeze, and at that point, this sunsets. And so then we will, it gives the legislature, it gives the industry, the Department of Ag, to go back, reevaluate, just like we did in 2005 and we're doing now. Was this the best route to take, and are there adjustments that need to be made in the program? So that's essentially what the bill does. Now, there is an issue on the sunset that we need to talk about, because that needs to be resolved, which is not quite correct in the LC draft. It needs to be fixed before February. Again, if there's any questions, Mr. Co-Chairs, I will turn it over to Katie.
Do you want to hear about the issue now, or do you want to wait?
Oh, you can wait until the end. I just want to know what's the issue with the sunset.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. Sean did a really nice job of going over the history of this program and what we've worked through with the industry over the course of the last 9 years or so. And I think we've kind of learned lessons in terms of fees. When I first came to the agency, fees were set and oftentimes not changed for 15 years. And what happens in that scenario is you have a steady fee for 15 years, but when you need the fee increase, it's a very sizable percentage increase. And we pretty much heard loud and clear that our fee payers don't like that at all. It's tough on their budget. So working with all of our customers, we instituted the increase a fee 2% a year for 5 years, and that ran from 2005 to 2010. Sunsetted, and based on that experience, we feel it's better to have an up-to amount, but in the course of the year, we will analyze what our fee revenue looks like, what our complete revenue picture looks like, and decide if we even need a fee at all, or if we do, what that range is, somewhere between 0 and 3%, and we would set those fees by administrative rule. Just a little background, the Food Safety Division in our agency inspects licenses and inspects all food safety establishments in the state of Oregon, with the exception of restaurants. Restaurants are done by health departments. So grocery stores, food processors, dairy processors, meat distributors, you name it. There are a number of licenses, and that's basically the reason why the LC is so thick, because we are adding that up to 3% for every license category that we have. The total number of establishments that we inspect in a given year is over 10,000 now. So it is a pretty significant workload for us. And we, over the course of time, as the number of establishments have increased, our staff size has not increased. And so we've really focused in on identifying high risk factors to food safety, and those are the kinds of things that we look for when we're in establishments. Basically, you keep hot food hot, you keep cold food cold, any other kind of places where bacteria or things can grow in food establishments, that's not what you want. And so when we go in and conduct inspections, we're really focusing in on those high-risk factors that we think can have the potential to cause a food safety outbreak. Food safety is pretty much top of mind here in the last 3 to 4 years, which is, in a way, unfortunate. A lot of national food recalls with very significant health concerns. sad but true, we had just this last summer a situation with strawberries grown in Oregon where we actually had a woman who died because she consumed strawberries. So as we look at kind of the national environment, the fact that the Congress just recently passed the Food Safety Modernization Act and is working towards trying to figure out how to implement that act, we work very closely with the Food and Drug Administration at the federal level. And then with our partners, Health Authority at the state level, to try to do the best job that we can to ensure a safe and wholesome food supply here in Oregon. This is a very, very critical program. It is funded with a mixture of other funds in general fund. Right now, the general fund represents around 37% of the program, and fee revenues represent 63%. So this bill, as Sean described, would adjust each of our license categories and allow the department to increase fees up to 3% a year for the next, I think this bill sunsets in 2019.
19, yeah.
We do not anticipate needing the fee increase this current year. The reason we need to put it in place now is we also learned this lesson historically. Our fee renewals go out in May. If we wait and we need a fee increase next year, we found it to be very challenging to get a fee increase bill through the legislature and get it signed in by the governor in time for us to send our renewals in May. So basically, passing this legislation this session will have that mechanism in place in case we need to do a fee increase for fiscal year 2013. The amendment that we're working on, we have lots of eyes that were reading the bill, and unfortunately we did not catch this when the bill was drafted last session. The language around the sunset could be interpreted that once this bill sunsets, the department could choose to set any fee it wanted. That's not the intent of the agency, so we're getting language. We're working on that now, and we'll have the amendment ready to go February 1 that basically says upon sunset in 2019, the fees are frozen. And then we'll work with the legislature, with industry groups, to come back in and determine, is it another up to 3%? Is it some different number? But basically, the department would not be able to, once that fee sunsets, let's say it's $100 for a certain category, on its own go out and raise the fees to $150. That's the intent of the amendment, to very much clarify what we would do with those fees. With that, happy to answer any questions.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Sean, you're with the grocers, but as Katie said, there's a whole bunch of people impacted on this. Is there a consensus among everyone in the industry that this should go for? I see some nodding heads. So,
Co-Chairs, Representative Shoffler, I can't speak for all the industry, but they obviously participated in 2005 and were supportive. They participated through this entire process, and so I will rely on them to nod their heads, but I don't believe there's any objections to this, and so, but I think mostly support.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, briefly, in a few days there are going to be people descending on this building like a bunch of vultures for looking for money, and for good reason, most of them for good reason, not all, I might add, but, you talked about the sweeps, so I'm not going to ever vote for any sweeps again. We did that. I've been down that road, but I see, with someone will be able to justify taking some of your general fund money because we're going to increase this fee. I just see that happening, and that's unfortunate, but a little commentary, Mr. Chair, forgive me.
Okay. Any further questions for these
two?
Yes, Representative Boone.
I just missed when Sean started. Who he's representing today?
Grocers.
Yep, Northwest Grocery Association.
Sure.
Thanks.
Yep. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, thank you, too.
Thank you.
Anybody else here on LC31 that joined us later wants to? Well, all right then. We'll close the public hearing on LC31 and open a public hearing on LC32. Do we have the sponsor or anything like that? Okay. Well, I don't believe that we've got so the committee technically is going to be the sponsor now that I think about it, assuming we vote to move it into session. But this is Representative Olson's bill, And he has one of ours over there, and so we, Representative Esquivel and I, said we could do his as a committee bill here since he was doing one for us over there. Mm-hmm. But he's not able to join us to explain it. And so we're going to have to, maybe you've got a little written description, and Beth can tell us a little bit about it, and then we'll hear from people who I'm not sure if they're happy about it. So I want you to hear at least why the proponents who authored the bill, at least a verbal description of what the point is of the bill from that perspective.
So LC 32 that you have in front of you and in your packets and updated online is an updated version that was, it didn't come out of LC until last night at the end of the day, and it's also in the back of the room. But it establishes the Commission on Soil Research within the Department of State Lands. It kind of makes some stipulations about the members of the commission that they must be residents of the state, well informed on land use issues, and have expertise in the science of soil research. It requires the commission to review all rules adopted by DSL to determine the economic impact of the rules and whether economic conditions have changed since adoption, thereby increasing the burden of compliance, and to write a report and to submit the report of its review to the Department of State Lands. Amongst other things, it stipulates that DSL may not reject wetland delineation report that was prepared by two or more soil scientists who are certified and in good standing by the Soil Science Society of America. It prohibits DSL from imposing on removal or fill permits and wetland conservation plans conditions that require measures beyond the replacement functions and values of the impacted water source. It declares an emergency as effective upon passage.
Okay. So...
And if it's necessary for me to explain the differences between the two drafts, I can, but if you're comfortable, I'm good.
And we've got four folks to testify here. So does anybody have any questions they want to answer before we go into public testimony?
We're just doing it, making a bill, right, Mr. Chair?
Representative Boone.
The version that's on the committee site is the latest.
Yes. Representative
Boone. Okay,
that's the one I've got, I think. Okay. Yeah, so it's dated 1/17/12.
Yes, it's dated 1/17/12.
Okay, hold on. Nope, I've got 12/21.
Let me email that to you right now, Representative Boone.
What's that?
I will email that to you right
thank
now.
Thank you. Thanks.
And I don't want to make you multitask, so once you're done with that, maybe it would be helpful to understand the differences so those in the audience who are just grabbing it for the first time.
No. Yeah, so the difference is just briefly is that the previous version, I'll explain the majority of them, the previous version had the governor appointing two people, one person to represent the public interest and one person to represent the league and cities. The League of Oregon Cities as well as, or cities and counties, I think is how it was worded. And then the new version that you have that's dated 1/17 has the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties jointly appointing one of the members. If I think it also has some stipulations in there that if they're not able to do that within a certain amount of time, of what it would default to.
The governor goes.
Speaker of the House and Speaker of the House.
Yeah, so then it lays out in the new version is the same in terms of how the other members are appointed. It also requires a commission to review all rules adopted by DSL to determine the economic impact of the rules and whether required economic conditions have changed since their adoption. The previous version kind of made it sound like that you had to review the rules as in terms of the economic time in which they were created. So if you reviewed a rule that was promulgated in 1998, you would have to compare it to 1998 economic standards, which wasn't the requester's intention. So that was just a miscommunication. And then this version just kind of makes it more clear and kind of specifies in a variety of statutes that DSLs... that when they're promulgating rules related to the removal, fill, and wetlands, that they have to be no more stringent than the federal laws require.
Okay. So let's call up Marge Easley, and I'll do the last three together, potentially as a group. We have four, so somebody's going to be up there by themselves. We'll let it be you, Marge.
Is it Senator Olson or Representative Olson?
Senator.
Representative.
Representative.
Yeah.
Andy?
Not that it matters. Yeah. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I actually don't really know the story behind this. I assume something led to this, some incident or something.
Mr. Chair?
I'd like to know.
Mr. Chair, can any of the witnesses tell us if we can mine more gravel if this bill passes?
I'm sure Louise Saliday could comment on that. Let's put it on that. Representative Springer.
Mr. Chair, I can speak to this bill or this LC just briefly. I'm slightly hesitant just because I don't want to speak to the details to any great measure because I wasn't prepared to speak about this and I don't want to misspeak. This emanates out of a situation, I believe, just outside of my district in Representative Olson's district that's been ongoing and... It's a very real problem on the ground, no pun intended, that has come to the point that there needs to be some resolution, absolutely, at the state level. This has been a very costly endeavor for the community. And so I think some people are going to speak a little bit more to that. And if I'm totally off base, then I'm ready for somebody to jump in and say, you're totally off base.
Thank you for trying, at least. Co-Chair Escobar.
Representative Springer, am I to assume, which, you know, is
I knew
shouldn't
I shouldn't
be
have
doing,
spoke.
Yeah, right.
But, in other words, what we've had is situations where people have hired experts in a field, and DSL has ignored that input. Is that basically what we're saying?
If we're talking about
the soil
this
sample.
Coming out of right. an issue just outside my district, it's a Lebanon area, but just outside my district, if we are speaking, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
if we are speaking to that issue, that certainly would be a safe assumption, in my opinion.
And we'll hear from DSL. Louise may know more what prompted this, too. So.
But I just, I am a little hesitant to go too far when I'm not speaking on.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Marge Easley, and I'm here representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I think most of you know that the League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League has followed issues surrounding wetlands and land use since the 1960s, and we've had members participating in technical advisory committees for DSL, and we've had positions on water quality since 1969. We have been studying water recently again and have researched issues of both water quality and quantity and have recently published two reports. And we participated in the adoption of HB 3369 in 2009 and have a member of the League serving on the Policy Advisory Group for the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. And we have similar credentials related to land use, and we've supported the Certified Site Program at Business Oregon. We also understand the importance of wetlands to the natural systems that help clean our water. We respect the intent of legislators to find solutions to addressing wetlands during development, but we feel that LC 32 is not the right approach. Soil scientists are not wetland scientists. Oregon statutes, as well as EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, define wetlands as follows. The term wetlands means those areas that are inundated or saturated by surface or groundwater at a frequency and duration sufficient to support, and that under normal circumstances do support, a prevalence of vegetation typically adapted for life in saturated soil conditions. Wetlands generally include swamps, marshes, bogs, and similar areas. This is the accepted federal and state definition and refers to the need for proper soils, vegetation, and water. This definition is used not only by DSL, but the Department of Land Conservation and Development, the Department of Forestry, the Department of Environmental Quality, Agriculture, and the Water Resources Department. Relying on soil scientists is neither adequate nor appropriate. Furthermore, we feel that establishing a new commission with political but not necessarily scientific knowledge surrounding an issue of scientific importance runs counter to Oregon's philosophy of addressing environmental issues with sound scientific research. Nor can we afford yet another commission in this time of budget constraints when we have competent staff at DSL to address this scientific issue. It's either a wetland or it isn't. Making a political decision doesn't change the facts. We ask that you not forward this legislation, and we thank you for this opportunity to share our concerns. Any questions?
Any questions? So I'm just, I hadn't had a chance since last night to read the newest one myself. The charge of the commission, I'm trying to figure out if the charge of the commission is actually review the wetlands delineations or this issue of whether rules have an economic impact or what the charge of the commission really is. The members must be residents who are well-informed on land use issues and have expertise in the science of soil research. And your point is that someone appointed by the Speaker of the House from legislature may not have land use issues or expertise in soil research, which is possible, obviously, but those two things might be in conflict from time to time.
They would not be legislators. They're just appointing one person.
It says one member.
I think we could get that
one
clarified.
Member of the commission, one member of the commission. One member of the
member of the commission, I believe.
Yes,
gotcha.
That is correct.
Gotcha.
I did talk with Elsie about that because
there's a
delineation of power issues.
So your concern would be that it's not,
it's,
even though there's a requirement that they be well-informed on land use issues and have expertise in soil science, that that's too loose a definition, and the speakers and president of the Senate, blah, 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 may appoint somebody who doesn't.
We feel it might be a political appointment rather than a scientist who really has knowledge of wetlands issues.
And Beth just pointed out to me that actually makes it clear they cannot be members of the Legislative Assembly, so they would be appointed by those offices, but not they wouldn't be us. It's probably wise, as you point out.
Well, I'm sure the governor doesn't do any political appointments either, huh?
Are these confirmed by the Senate? No.
Yeah, Senate President appoints one.
Yeah, I just meant that they face confirmation hearings that they don't. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Notwithstanding the comments, from the League of Oregon Cities, or the League of Women Voters, excuse me. I've spent 16 years in this assembly, and during that 16-year period of time, I've listened on numerous occasions to people talking about and advocating about science. I've heard more discussions about from dueling scientists, if you wish, than I need to have. And coming out of a profession where I consider myself to have been a scientist, I've been somewhat often amazed at the lack of credentials that are necessary to call yourself a scientist as you come before the Oregon legislature. But be all of that as it may, I think the request of the LC, and by the way, I was asked to be a chief co-sponsor on this legislation. At one time, I have not taken on that dubious honor, but be that as it may, I think the issue is real. And whether people like it or whether they don't like it, the issue is there, it's real, and it is being perceived on the part of many people as some considerable interference in the process of making some changes, and as such I think it is important, it will be important for us as a committee to go through the process that we go through in the legislature of hearing the pros and the cons on this issue and making the decision at that level, remembering always that every body of rules, every law that we have has come to us via the political process. And it is the political process that has given us this kind of mystical idea of science determining whatever it is that we want to do, and without the political process of having done that, that discussion wouldn't even be open, here. So I'm highly in favor of moving the process forward here, understanding at this point that I'm making no commitment to either be a chief co-sponsor, because I haven't read in its entirety all of the material, nor making any kind of a commitment as to what I might do in the future on this committee in relationship to this bill. I'll make those decisions when I have heard, if I get to hear them, all of the pros and cons in relationship to the problem with the political biases that go with those pros and cons. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You could respond to that if you like, but I'm not sure that was...
I'm not demeaning the political process. The League is very much in favor of the political process, and but we feel that wetlands has been defined pretty specifically, and there's a general agreement on the definition of wetlands. And so we just feel that changing or interpreting the definition of wetlands should not be up to a commission that may not have the scientific background that would be adequate to know a wetlands when they see it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'll go ahead. Before I call it the next day, I'll remind folks again of the sort of practice that the legislative committees have engaged in. When you vote for the introduction of committee legislative concepts, it in no way indicates your support for the actual underlying concept. It's just, can we introduce this bill? Then we'll have a real hearing on the merits of it. It's helpful to have these hearings. Obviously, we're required to, but it's helpful to have them to get the advocates any arguments that they might face against it and see if they could work out amendments, whatever, between now and 10 days from now. But I have the same. I actually haven't yet heard the backstory to this one, but I did commit to get it drafted by the committee, so my intent is to have it move forward to at least its first hearing and hear about it at that time from hopefully the sponsor of the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shoffler.
I share my wonderful colleagues' sentiments about the discussion of science and expertise and all this in this building. Matter of fact, I sat on his, was a freshman on the water committee with then Chair Jensen, and I quickly learned that it was a futile exercise in this building trying to change something, and that mystical, philosophy we've built up as if Oregon stands with one philosophy, that always irritates me because we're very diverse. But Mark Twain, we want experts up here, okay? Mark Twain defined an expert as someone from out of town. And I think that's what we get, a lot of people from out of town around here. Anyway, that's my humble opinion. But
my grandpa said it was somebody somewhere 50 miles from home.
Well, same thing.
Okay, so I'm going to call the next three up together. Louise Soliday, Randy Tucker, and Sue Marshall. Louise, since it's your division that would be inheriting the new... your department that would be inheriting a new commission, et cetera, et cetera. Why don't you start and tell us what you know about this?
Co-Chair Clem, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. So I believe the situation that gives rise to this bill is something that occurred back in 2006 when we had a property owner in Lebanon who had submitted a wetland delineation to us in the spring of 2006 that had actually been completed back in 2005. And my staff, in reviewing the delineation, wanted to go out to the site and set up a site visit to go out. And when they went out to the site to review the site, discovered that construction was already underway, impacting wetlands on the site without a permit from us. The landowner had a wetland delineation done back in the 1990s, And we have a process that has wetland delineations expire after 5 years. And had conversations with legislators about that five-year period and is that the right number. And I think it's we're open to conversation about that, whether they should, you know, expire in 10 years or 5 years. For us, that's not a big issue, but the situation that gave rise to this is the facts have been muddled. We are in litigation over that particular situation, not over the facts of the situation, but two of my staff have been charged with defamation of character by a consultant who came in after we discovered the violation, not the consultant who did the original delineation on the property. So there is a lot of history to this particular parcel, but I think the issues that come up in that parcel are issues that do come up other places, and I think they're worthy of conversation. I do have concerns with this legislative concept. I've been having a lot of conversations with, well, I'm going to say a lot, several conversations with Senator Morse about this issue as well. Senator Morse and Representative Olson represent an area that is rich in wetlands, and so wetlands issues come up as a limiting factor in development in a number of places. And we've got some things going on to try and address the concern, particularly in the Mid-Willamette Valley, where this is a big issue. I just want to talk about a couple issues with the bill, and then talk about. We're open to a conversation about what's the real problem we're trying to solve here and how might we be able to best solve it. The way this bill approaches this issue is it sets up this commission of people who are supposed to be experts in soil research. The folks who do wetland delineations in the state of Oregon run the range from people who have no credentials to people who are highly credentialed. There are soil scientists by the certified soil scientists, there are certified wetland scientists, and there are different professional organizations that certify those various scientists. But we have people who hang their shingle up and do wetland delineations who have been trained but who don't have any certifications from any of the professional organizations. And we generally get, when we get delineations in the door, the vast majority of them are accepted as they're submitted to us. We help train these people in how to do the delineations. There's a long-standing protocol that's been developed by the Corps of Engineers going back to the late 1980s. It's been supplemented over time, but there is a standard procedure that anybody who's doing wetland delineations uses. And what my staff does is review those delineations to make sure that they follow the manual and that the data that they collected as a part of doing the delineation supports the conclusions that they've come to. In most cases, we agree. We're to the point now where we're doing our initial review on wetland delineations at an average of about 60 days. It used to be that we were taking 4 months or more, so we've shrunk that time considerably. And I think part of that is a result of the training that we've tried to do with folks and my staff getting better at doing their reviews. The way this commission is structured, it's set up to do an economic review, and I'm not sure that people who are specialists and soil scientists are the ones who have the expertise to do an economic review. We do have a long-standing technical advisory committee that meets monthly or every other month, which is open to anybody who wants to participate on it. We have representatives from AOC and LOC, so the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Cities. We have representatives from the League of Women Voters. We have representatives from the Farm Bureau. We have representatives from the conservation community. We have wetland consultants. It is open to anybody who wants to participate. We use that technical advisory committee anytime we're doing rulemaking as our rules advisory committee. We bring in drafts of our rules to that committee. We have them go through them. We talk about not just the practical implications of those rules on the ground, but also the economic impacts. And that's why we want the consultant community and the affected customers to be part of that technical advisory committee to help us look at not just how things are going to work from a practical perspective, but also how they work from an economic and a fiscal perspective. This bill does propose to change the five-year period to a 10-year period. If we do that, there are winners and losers. We go through climatic cycles, so we go through wet periods and we go through dry periods. We also have development going on around a lot of our wetlands, which changes the hydrology. In a lot of cases, it cuts off the hydrology and the wetlands go away. So if we change from a five-year to 10-year period, you need to understand that some people will benefit from that and some people will not benefit from that. And it just depends on whether you did a delineation in a wet period or a dry period and what kind of development has occurred around that particular site, if we wait and have them expire in 10 years. So that conversation we're open to. Having consultants, in this case, the way this bill would work, having two soil scientists, if any two soil scientists agree on a delineation, this says the department has to concur with it. We have a problem with that. First of all, wetlands are not just about soil. They're about hydrology and they're about vegetation. So you can't just have soil science expertise and be able to evaluate. Doesn't mean you can't get the training to do that, but I would not feel comfortable having consultants themselves decide that a delineation meets the criteria. Our job is to be the neutral party. That is, we've got a manual that folks are supposed to be using. We're reviewing those delineations using what's in that manual to make a decision about whether they have delineated the wetlands properly. As I've said, in the vast majority of cases, we don't have a problem. Where we do, it's usually a short back and forth to get things resolved. In some cases, we get a delineation in the door that we think completely misses the mark. The data doesn't support the conclusions. It doesn't match with what was previously mapped. It doesn't match with what is going on in the surrounding properties. And those are the ones that we have a tough time with, and those are the ones that give rise to issues like this. The language in here about only requiring folks to replace lost values and functions is already in the statute. We already do that. It's the standard that we ask people to meet. We don't ask people to go beyond that standard. If we did, we would be going beyond what's allowed in the law. This bill would add that language to several other sections of the bill. It's already in the statutes. It's already what we do. We are getting better in terms of using a methodology to determine what those values and functions are. It used to be historically, if you impacted an acre of wetland, you had a ratio that you had to meet to mitigate for that impact. We are getting much better at looking at what values and functions are impact as opposed to the size of the impact and having people do their mitigation for the impacts of those values and functions. We've developed a rapid assessment tool for folks to use. We are constantly improving that. It's been in place for a couple of years. We have several improvements that the consultants have said, if you make these changes, it'll make this process even better. So we are headed down a path to try and do that. I haven't had a time to look at the bill that came out late yesterday, but as I understand in just quickly reviewing it, it looks as though it adds in several sections of our statutes this federal stringency, so don't do anything that's more stringent than the federal government requires. The place where we differ with the federal government is in our jurisdiction, what we take jurisdiction over. The definition of waters of the state is a little broader than the definition of waters of the U.S. under the Clean Water Act. So we have some mostly isolated wetlands that we require a permit for that the federal government does not require a permit for. But in terms of our requirements in terms of mitigation, requirements for doing wetland delineations, permit requirements, we are fairly consistent with the federal permitting process. One of the things that we are now looking at seriously is whether the state should assume the federal permitting process. And it's something that we are allowed to do under the Clean Water Act, just as the Department of Environmental Quality has assumed the 401 program, 403. We are looking at whether we should assume the 404 program. If we did that, we would eliminate the duplicative permitting process for a vast majority of the state. We cannot assume the 404 program for the entire state. We cannot assume it for federally navigable waters, which are covered under the what's called Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act. Those are most of the major rivers, so the Columbia, the main stem of the Columbia, the main stem of the Willamette, are coastal waters in the estuaries where they are used for commerce and navigation. But for the rest of the state, we can assume the program. We have set up a subgroup of our technical advisory committee that's helping to advise us through that process. I think given the continuing issues that we have continued to hear about, we believe that one of the biggest problems that our applicants are facing is that they do have both federal and state permitting, and the federal permitting brings in other permitting, so you need a 401 water quality certification. You have to go through consultation under the Endangered Species Act with both National Marine Fisheries Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we think that if we assume the 404 program, we may be able to streamline that federal process significantly for our landowners in Oregon. Last thing I just want to speak to, there's a provision in the bill that would eliminate mitigation requirements for wetland impacts of less than an acre in urban growth boundaries. That has would result in a significant loss of wetlands in the state of Oregon, and we have a policy of no net loss of wetlands in our statutes. And so there is a concern. A lot of people, when you say the word wetlands, depending on who you say it to, it has a bad connotation and it has a good connotation. And on the good side, wetlands are really important ecological features on the landscape. They help store water. They help dissipate energy from floodwaters. They provide wildlife habitat. They help filter pollutants out of our waters slowly. So they provide a number of functions on the landscape. If you want to impact them under current law, you need to either avoid those impacts if you can. If you can't avoid them, you need to minimize the impacts. And if you can't do that, then you need to mitigate for those impacts. We have a variety of options for people to mitigate those impacts, from doing their own mitigation to purchasing from a private wetland mitigation bank. We have about 23 of those around the state at this point and several more under review. You can make a payment into a fund where we collect the money and turn around and do the mitigation on the ground through a grant program. So there's a variety of options that people can use when they have to mitigate for those wetland impacts. With that, I'm happy to take any questions. As I said, we're open to hearing about one other thing I do want to mention. With this Mid-Willamette Valley issue that we have a number of industrial sites that are zoned for industrial use that have wetlands on them. We have been working through the Mid-Willamette Valley COG, the Council of Governments there, and six cities on a process to get those industrial sites that are in those cities pretty much shovel ready. That is, get the wetland delineations done, identify the mitigation, and maybe even having the mitigation done in advance so that when companies come looking at those sites, that those cities can say that they truly are shovel ready, they've been through the wetland delineation process. And what we are hoping that will come out of that process is that the department will issue a general permit that will cover all of those sites so that those sites are truly ready to go if and when developers are ready to develop them. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think we'll finish and with the panel and then come back to questions. So, Randy, you're next.
Okay. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. In your comments, Representative Schaffler, about experts, the way I heard the quote was something like, an expert is someone who's more than 50 miles from home and shows slides. So I didn't bring any PowerPoint, but
You're not an expert.
My point exactly. Thank you. This is not my area of expertise. However, I would like to make some brief comments on the bill that's before you. Some of my colleagues have alerted me to the provision that Louise just discussed a minute ago, having to do with small wetlands of less than 1 acre inside an urban growth boundary, and I'd like to just comment briefly on that. The public has repeatedly told Metro, both in opinion polls and also through the passage of some fairly hefty bond measures for acquiring natural areas throughout the Portland region for the purpose of protecting water quality and wildlife habitat, that those are values that are important to them. And in response to both public opinion and also state land use goals, Metro adopted some regional standards and programs to protect natural resources several years ago that have continued to be updated, and that cities and counties have then adopted at the local level. The standards, or the program that Metro has relies on a mix of regulation and acquisition and voluntary activities and education to achieve its objectives, and we've tried very hard not to duplicate existing standards and protections that exist. So while our program regulates riparian areas and upland areas, and the upland areas it regulates are only those that are outside the UGB and urban reserves, we don't have any regulations on the wetlands because DSL has those regulations. And so, but that's considered part of our overall tapestry of protections that exist in the region. So my colleagues are concerned that elimination of the protection for these small wetlands would impact our overall program in the region. We also try to balance the need for development and the need for protection pretty carefully. With our own regulations, they're somewhat softer in industrial areas where it's important to provide employment, or actually employment areas in general. We like Louise described, we have situations with our regulations that are not absolute bans on development, but actually call on people to avoid or minimize or mitigate if possible, and we work closely with people on that. So I would just like to express concern about the particular provision. It's in the new draft. It's on Section 5, which is on page 8 toward the bottom, lines 28 through 31, but you've already heard what it does. And that's the concern I'd like to express on the record today.
Okay. Sue.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall, and I'm here today representing Tualatin Riverkeeper and Audubon Society of Portland. We oppose this legislative concept as it's currently written, although I haven't had a chance to really do a fine comb on the new draft, but agreeing with everything that's already been stated, our significant concerns relate to, we believe this seriously undermines the state's authority to protect wetlands by denying DSL's ability to reject a wetland delineation. Wetlands are waters of the state. They're held in trust by the public. It is the state's responsibility to assure protection of them, and as was stated, the overarching goal is no net loss. We don't believe that should be transferred to private entities, to consultants that come up with agreeable delineations that are paid for by the development interests. We think that as a backstop, we may not always agree, we may not like, or we may like some of the decisions that DSL arrives at, but it really is the state's responsibility to be that backstop. There currently is a process for challenging DSL delineations, and I checked with Director Soliday in advance, and apparently since 1999, the department has had 12 requests for reconsideration, four of which have resulted in changes that decisions that DSL had made related to the wetland delineation. So we think there's a process in place that people can go through if they disagree with a DSL decision. Finally, we're very concerned about the elimination of mitigation requirements for wetlands that are under 1 acre within UGB. Portland Audubon Society did an GIS analysis just looking at the mapped wetlands within the greater Portland metro area, and roughly 54% of the mapped wetlands within the UGB are under 1 acre. If you consider the wetlands that aren't mapped, not all wetlands are mapped, that would increase that number significantly. While these may be small wetlands in and of themselves, collectively, if there's no mitigation for filling those wetlands, then you're going to have a serious hydrologic impact in the urban area that's going to be negative related to flood storage, water quality, and impact a number of property owners. So I think that is a very serious concern that we have. Thank you very much for the opportunity to comment on this legislative concept. I understand that folks aren't obligated to, by forwarding this, that there would be ultimate support, but we would encourage you really to not forward this at all. Thank you.
Okay, questions for this panel? Representative Schaffler.
I just wanted to thank Louise and the Department of State Lands for all the help you did on the best bill that passed last session, House Bill 2700, Linear Project Permit Bill, that will help facilitate pipelines for energy and water and anything else, LNG, anything else. I want to thank you for your help on that. We've restored some reason to this permit process here in the state of Oregon. I'm grateful for that. After 10 years of painful lack of reason. I grew up in Iowa, and there used to be fence line to fence line. They plowed up and planted. And for a lot of different reasons, a lot of farmers have went back to restoring wetlands and draws. One, they weren't making any money on it. You can't grow in a lot of that. But and a lot of it was for very enlightened reasons, for water fowl, water habitat, water critters. And in Happy Valley, we purchased some, what used to be a dairy farm land right in the Valley Bowl. And the city, and I don't even fall out of their chair, but I was very much supportive of this. We've restored that area into a beautiful wetlands, part of our city park, and there's a boardwalk through it. It's really nice. And you said, Sue, we haven't mapped all the wetlands. I'm not convinced that we are. I think we may be, wetlands may be growing in Oregon, and it could easily be done, and I think it could be economically done as well. The problem, what brings this bill about? It's we, whether real or perceived, and in certain specific cases it's real, we have a path to know in this state. And when we've got people that are on unemployment for 99 months and falling off, we need to find a path to yes. Now let's carve out the metropolitan area out of this bill. There, that solves that. Put some hydraulics on there rather than just all the experts. There you go. But we need to, I don't believe, and my friends already alluded to it, We are on a path to know in this state, whether real or perceived, and we have to change that perception if it's not real. And we are on a path to know. I would not invest my money in this state if I were going to build a big business. I would not do it. I'm grateful for those that are, and I'm grateful especially for those who signed project labor agreements with my brothers and sisters in the union, but I wouldn't come here. And it's because of this just constant obstruction and third-party appeals who, be quite frankly, aren't experts, should have some kind of expertise, but they can willy-nilly come in and appeal.
without ever paying any court costs or lawyer fees. Constant appeals, lose every appeal, and then the property owner's stuck holding the bag and paying for that whole process, which is unnecessary and I think should be illegal. So if you want to stop stuff like this, I suggest you find ways to get us on a path to yes, because we're not on a path to yes, in my humble opinion, Mr. Chair.
It's not particularly a question, I don't think.
But there's no question there.
You're welcome to respond if you like. Representative Boone.
Yeah, I just noticed as I was listening to the testimony, there's a line that keeps coming up, and I'm wondering if there's some response from both DSL and Metro and Riverkeepers and Audubon representatives. And it's the part that says, provided that the program for replacement of planned wetland losses and restoration of lost function and values does not require any measures beyond the replacement of the functions and values of any impacted water resources of the state. And it's that, to me, maybe I'm taking that wrong, but I think what they're saying is they would replace or mitigate for any lost function or value, but they would not be required to go beyond that amount of function or value that has been lost or compromised. Am I wrong on that, or and is there a problem with that? That's the thing. It pops up about 5 or 6 times. 15 pages.
Louise, do you?
Yeah, Co-Chair Clemon, Representative Boone, that is already in statute. So that is the standard by which we make those decisions. It's in 196.825(5). And so we already have that requirement in statute. We are not opposed to that. It is the process that we currently use.
Okay.
Thank you.
If you don't mind, I have a comment. I think that there would be some value in looking at and evaluating over time the status of wetlands in the state, whether we are able to achieve that goal of no net loss. I think in the not too distant past, mitigation really was kind of hit and miss, and I think that there's a much better approach to successful mitigation for wetland losses. And Tualatin Riverkeepers, in fact, was an award winner for a mitigation project of the year from DSL. So I think when you apply for a permit, it could be yes and it could be no. Part of the avoidance, and maybe where we've gotten into trouble, is we don't avoid earlier in the land use process when it comes to zoning, where you can actually select the best places to have shovel-ready projects where you don't run into conflicts related to wetlands. So I think that there could be a better path to yes than we have right now, but by identifying most appropriate places to develop. And in some cases that Louise had mentioned in the Mid-Willamette Valley, places were zoned that are wetlands, and you're going to run into a higher price for development and conflicts.
All right, Co-Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As for the 5-year plan versus the 10-year plan, there's got to be winners and losers there as well. So I don't think that's a valid argument. The other thing is, the government does not have all the answers. I can tell you that right now. Isn't it interesting that we're discussing preservation of wetlands, yet if you want to create a wetland and have a pond on your property, you still have to go ask the government for permission? I think that's pretty ironic. But you have to get a permit. And if you want to have a permit process, have one. But if you're rejected, you don't have to pay for it. If it's a yes, then you pay for it. That's a fair deal. I think that government has a tendency to overstep its bounds. I think that just because you work for the government doesn't necessarily mean you're an expert. So that's my 2 cents.
So Co-Chair Clemon, Co-Chair Esquivel, on the 5 and 10 year issue, I was just making the point, whether it's, pick a number, there will be winners and losers in whatever number you pick. We're not saying we're opposed to moving from 5 to 10 years, just understand that if we do that, some people are going to benefit and some people are not. And
like they currently are.
That's correct. If you look at our numbers in terms of our delineations and our permits, since I've been at DSL since 2006, we have denied one permit in that five-year period of time, and it was for housing development in Eugene back in 2006 or early 2007. It is a rare occasion that we deny permits. There are some very complex projects that take us time to get to yes, but it is a very rare occurrence for us to say no. With regard to wetland delineations, over 90% of the delineations that come in are concurred with. It's a very rare occurrence that we reject a wetland delineation. So the statistics indicate that the problem that we're talking about is a relatively small problem. I get the perception versus the reality, absolutely, because all it takes is one high-profile case and people think that it is the way the world works. We don't say no very often. We work very closely with the consultants and our landowners to get them to yes. When we make a permit decision, we have to be able to legally defend it. And when we have complex projects, we want to make sure we have those I's dotted and the T's crossed so that when we get challenged, because we will get challenged on those, that we can get them upheld in the court system, and we've been fairly successful at that. So I hear what you're saying. I recognize that there are ongoing concerns. We're open to the discussion, but I want to make sure that we're defining what the problem is that we're trying to solve and make sure that we're coming up with something that actually is going to solve that problem.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that just leads into to a great question and point, I think, and to the department. That's, I think, truly that is where this bill is coming from. Do we have a good process in place? And is everybody holding all the cards? One side holding all the cards? And so, if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chair, just very briefly, because we don't want to get into the weeds of everything this does, because my guess is nobody in this room has spent enough time on this bill yet to totally understand this bill. We're talking about a conversation that does need to take place. And it needs to take place because there's at least a perception, I believe a reality, that it is not always an equitable process, and it's not always a clear process. As far as aerial photos, I'm assuming those are sometimes used for determinations, delineations of wetlands?
Co-Chair Clem and Representative Springer, they are.
And Mr. Chair. Please. And so then in that process with aerial photos, is there a time frame or any requirements of how recent those pictures are?
Co-Chair Clem and Representative Springer, you're going to get into the particulars of a situation. And
no,
so,
no, I'm not.
But,
no, I'm not.
What I'm saying is, for us, that's site-specific. So there are a series of aerial photos for the state of Oregon. There are some that have been ground-truthed, others that haven't. Aerial photos is one piece of information that's used in doing wetland delineations. It's not the only piece of information that's used.
Well, Mr. Chair, and let me be very clear. I'm not talking about the specifics of a case. I'm asking about department policy.
Mm-hmm.
What does the department policy say about the age of a photo, aerial photo that's used?
Co-Chair Clem and Representative Springer, I don't know if we have an age limit on the aerial photos.
We look at whatever photos are available.
Well, hold on, sorry.
Hang on. Yeah.
We just got to get you to, I'll have you come up. Actually,
I can go.
Okay.
Away.
Yeah. Well, Joanna, just so we know who the voice is for the radio audience.
So my staff is going to join me who can get more down into the weeds on this.
Then, of course, you have to identify yourself.
Don't stomp on them weeds. They might be protected.
Right. And we have
Coaches Clem and Esquivel. I'm Bill Ryan. I'm the Assistant Director in charge of the Wetlands and Waterways Conservation Division at the Department of State Lands. And in response to the question about aerial photos, we don't have a standard specific to aerial photos. It is a common practice to look at whatever aerial photos are available, the most recent as well as the oldest, to see trends over time, because often photos are taken at different times of year, taken after in ag lands, after harvest, before harvest, what have you. So having a series of photos, especially ones taken at different times of year and over time, really give you a better idea as to what's happening on the ground in terms of the hydrology and the vegetation that's developed there.
Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Actually, I don't have a follow-up question there. Sure. This is exactly why we need to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. This right here is what is the standard. I wasn't asking about a case that is in the courts now. I was asking about what's the standard, and I think that's something that ought to be very clear in the department's eyes to clearly give answers to people that are going through this process. And in this, we're also making some assumptions that the delineations are made on a standard set of facts that never change, that they're all done in the same type of process, and I don't believe that is true. I just don't. And so I think that this is a very important conversation. I think there needs to be some checks and balances here within this process. It becomes very onerous for somebody who wants to make Oregon their home and do business here.
Okay. Representative Shoffler.
Briefly, Mr. Chair. Luis, you mentioned some statistics, and I'm grateful to hear that you're not. I believe you. I no reason to not believe that you're willy-nilly denying people permits. I know you're not doing that. But there's one piece of information that I don't think we can even quantify it. How many potential investors there's a lot of research and work done coming up to that permit acceptance. And how many potential investors may take a look at it, ask someone to take a look at doing this and say, nah, we're going to Texas. Now, I don't want to be Texas. I don't want Portland to be Dallas, Fort Worth, or L.A. or anything like that, or Phoenix. But, you know, that statistic, it's good, but I don't think it shows the whole story. How many people come in and examine all the hoops we got? And I'm not against wetlands, and I like clean water. By the way, I have a 18-year-old who turned 18, a new woman voter. I'm grateful she registered before she turned 18. So I'm not against the wetland idea. But I think that statistic's misleading, because how many people said, the hell with this, I'm not even going to apply, because I ain't going to get, I've done the research, I'm going somewhere else. Even though I believe there probably could be a way to get them a permit if it wasn't so. And how much does it cost to do all that research? I mean, it's so incredibly prohibitive. It's just another obstruction. And I think we need to clear the path a little bit, that path to yes. And I don't think we're doing a good job of it. I just don't think we are. This bill, I think, has a very slim chance of passing as it's written. But the conversation should be had, and I think you can't tell me we can't find a better way to get people to invest in the state and put unemployed people back to work.
Okay, thank you very much. I might request, well, actually, first we'll see what bill, I assume it will actually get out today, so then I don't know if it'll come to this committee or not. If it does, I need a lot of background on wetlands.
Yeah.
I mean, Oregon is a wet place. I assume we've got way more than Texas does right off the bat. So I need to understand their function, our responsibility to carry the load for the rest of the world on having the wettest place on earth, blah, blah, blah. Because I have not, unfortunately, studied any of it. I almost made you walk me through what an entire delineation is, because I don't even know that I know what that is. So if we go further on this, I'm going to be doing lots of homework on wetlands.
Mr. Chair, trust me, we have more in March than we do in August.
More in March, yeah, right, yeah. Okay, thank you very much. And I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 32.
Don't take your picture off.
Open LC.
A lot of subjectivity to the whole process down here.
Sorry. That's wrong.
Oh, that's okay. LC 89.
Bill Hoyt. Mm-hmm. Can Bill Hoyt join us?
This is your bill.
Oh, Representative Jensen, do you want to talk about this first?
No, go ahead, Bill. I'll talk about it.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Clem, Chair Esquivel, members of the committee, my name is Bill Hoyt. I'm the legislative chair for the Oregon Cattlemen Association, immediate past president, and I'm speaking in favor of this bill today. I'd like to give you just a brief update of conditions in northeast Oregon in terms of wolf areas. As most of you are aware, there has been a lawsuit filed in court to prevent the Department of Fish and Wildlife from executing the planned dealing with wolves from a lethal standpoint in northeast Oregon, and that has put a lot of pressure on those folks who are under the gun in terms of having wolves in their area. Since that stay of execution, if you will, or stay that is part of the wolf plan, that the state has the opportunity to deal with offending wolves after having been requested from the landowner and having had multiple depredations occur that were confirmed. This is part of the wolf plan, and they were about to put that into action when the department was sued. A stay was ordered, and since that stay, there have been at least seven depredations on the same multiple ranches. There are probably two or three that are very involved. And there are lots of different solutions that have come up, and people say, well, what do we do? We have a compensation bill that the committee passed last session. Those funds have been placed in suspension until the end of this session, the coming session. So there is no opportunity for anyone to be compensated as we speak, not to say that that won't happen in the future. I believe that the bill will give some fair tax credit to those who have confirmed kills. It's not asking for anything that is not out of order, in my opinion, for producers who have suffered confirmed losses, that they would be able to apply for tax credit based on the value of that of the animals lost. Pretty simple. We're in favor of it, and we appreciate the representative for bringing it forward. So thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for your comments. Appreciate everyone's comments on our issues, we really do, and all natural resource issues. So thank you so much.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, this measure I have brought forward because of the predation that we've had on wolves or on cattle in the northeast Oregon, especially in relationship to, I guess it's now the infamous Imnaha pack, and they seem to have discovered something that some of the other wolves in Oregon have apparently not yet discovered, and that's that cattle are slower than deer and elk, and therefore a somewhat easier target, and it makes for a good fattening for the winter months, you know, for the wolves. Editorial comments beside the point. The reason that I brought this forward is because fundamentally the rancher has no way to protect his investment and himself on this. Yes, we passed a bill, and I'm grateful to every member of the committee and every member of the legislature who supported us in passing of that bill. And I think it was a good first step, and I think we all realized it was merely a first step at the time that we were doing it. But that's not solved our issue or solved our problem. And these people have an incredible investment in the animals out there, and they are asked, because another segment of our society wants to protect the wildlife and wants to, you know, and that's okay. They have every right to do that. I mean, like everybody has a right to, you know, advance their beliefs and issues forward to the legislature. But I think if that segment of the society is going to have the right to do that, that segment of society should also be responsible to pay the cost for doing it. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit old-fashioned, but I kind of believe that that's a fair way to go, that you want something, it's only fair that you pay for it. And therefore, in reference to this, the only way I see to really pay for it is coming out of what would be eventually general funds. Mm-hmm. That was the intention of our bill last session, to kind of do that. And this would be kind of merely an extension of this. Now, one of the things that I've heard some criticism of the bill on was, can't the cattlemen, you know, write this off in their income tax, you know, type of thing. And I've taken the time to confer with CPAs that happen to do business with cattlemen and have a number of cattlemen, you know, that are clients of theirs, and it depends upon you know, the individual operation of whether they're able to deduct this lost animal from their taxes, and there are some that can't do that.
You have to make money in order to have deduction.
Well, yeah, you always have to. That's another minor point in there, but besides the issue of making money, there's also a matter of how you know, whether you inventory your entire herd. Some of the ranchers do not inventory their entire herd because of whatever their reasons are. So the idea of the bill is simple. I'm not saying that it may not need some work as it gets into committee, because I think every bill needs work when it goes to committee. And, you know, that's another time, another place to do it. But I think the concept of having the general fund through a tax credit to these individuals seems to be only a fair route to go. So, and I thank you, Mr. Chair, Chairs, for your willingness for me to inject this particular bill in here, since I'd already blown my two bills that I had somewhere else on other things before I had this grandiose idea. Thank you very kindly, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that members of the committee have on from me on this.
Yeah, I think Coach Esquivel had something.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious, and I think you pretty much outlined the difference between is it beneficial to have a credit or a deduction, or which one's more beneficial?
Do you
go and you get your net that you pay, and then you get a credit off of that, or do you get it off the gross? How does this work?
It's I've been asked that question.
I mean, you know, you were saying how do you get it? How do you take a deduction on something that you're losing money
right,
on?
Right.
I understand that.
We get told on a daily basis that, well, you know, that these animals are worth a great deal more today than they have been over the last. I mean, I've been in this all my life. I've seen these calves be worth 30 cents, and now they're worth $1.30. So there has been significant increase in the value of these calves and the value of the cows, their mothers. However, the cost of production
is so great today. We haven't experienced $4 diesel, so that just to run our operations is a lot more expensive. So when you look at the bottom line and say, all right, this is what my costs are, this is what my income is, a deduction can only be taken when the income exceeds the cost. You have a gross profit, then you can have losses deducted from that gross profit, which narrows that margin and makes your tax liability to be lessened by that. This bill gives a direct tax credit, which is different from a deduction, and that's why we were supporting.
That's what I wanted to delineate that, because I mean, my stepdad was a log truck driver, and he said he always had one truck that lost money, so he'd buy nine more to make it up in volume.
and there is an economy of scale everywhere, but the bottom line is that and most people have a hard time deciding, all right, how do I do that? But I agree.
Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in it, but from what I've learned over the years, what's not in here is the lack of weight gain, the stress on these animals, their reproductive process is interfered with, early birth of calves, and you're not asking for anything in that. I think you should.
Well, and the thing, Representative Schaffler, the response to that is that the system today only will allow for confirmed kills. Mm-hmm. And the individual who has experienced the most number of losses has told me that when he brings his calves in, he has suffered at least 40 or 50 calves that are not accounted for. So his beyond normal losses is another one we talked about in the bill when we discussed the bill that was passed, the compensation bill. If there were funds left over, after confirmed and probables were paid, then it would be possible to apply for above normal losses, that term. And there are ranchers experiencing losses that have been historically much greater over the last 3 or 4 years than they had in the past before wolves came to the area. The other thing, as you stated very well, is that we have not yet talked about the highest number of losses are really not the lethal losses. The death losses are smaller, in my opinion, than the and what one you didn't state is that the complexion of the cow herd in terms of how you would manage it and its personality, if you will, is totally changed. So one, I can't use my dogs anymore because the cows are so canine averse so our tools that are taken out of the box are taken out, and the cows become personality much harder to deal with, much ornerier, harder. They fight with you all the time, which causes the people involved to be at higher personal risk of injury. These things are not accounted for at all, not to mention the pregnancy rates. We make our money because right now we're calving. Mm. And in the next 90 days, we're going to get these cows bred back for next year's crop. And if those pregnancy rates go down, our income down the road is significantly impacted. And the fact that the body condition, if I go into winter, after having had a cow harassed all summer long because she's stressed all summer, her body condition going into winter is lower than it would have been if she were more comfortable and not stressed during the summer. And now it takes more feed and more energy to keep her going through that winter, tough winter process. So it, and you know, as we look at, we talk in every other area about the ecosystem and how it's all connected. Well, this has a huge connected part of how this one input affects the entire system. And so I think the personality change of the cow herd is significant. And I've talked to guys who say, well, you know, I'm at risk personally. You know, if a rancher gets hurt because of cow, and there have been several deaths in the last year where ranchers were killed working cows. Now, you know, we all realize we deal with that every day. But if we have now heightened that potential because we have made these cows much more difficult to deal with, because we've introduced this predator, it makes a significant impact, and we have never calculated that, and we have to deal in the Cattlemen's Association politically with what we're dealing with here, with the realities of confirmed kills, because that's where it's migrated to, and unfortunately that's what we have to deal with, and we do the best we can with that.
Representative Springer, and then come back over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I'm noticing in the bill is under Section 2, Subsection 3, it talks about certifying that somebody that is qualified, an expert, didn't we just talk about experts? Somebody that's qualified to certify that the kill was by a predator. And I'm sure that we're going to be careful with that language. I think that's very key. It's a very important piece. I do think you should be compensated because we've taken away the tools for you to defend yourself. So now I think since we've made that choice, then the consequence of that is then we do have to pay for it and you need to be compensated. Where I would take exception, and I think that this language is covering it and getting us there, is... You shouldn't be getting a tax credit for a predator kill when it's a dog, and that does occur. I was a deputy for many years and investigated those. You should be compensated by the owner of the dog. And we've given you tools to deal with that, ironically, but we haven't given you tools to deal with this. And so I think there's no question there. Sorry. I think that's a very important key, and we need to really carefully hone in on that piece, because I do want to compensate you for legitimate kills. I want other people to compensate you for the kills they're responsible for. And again, we take your tools away, then I guess we've got to pay for it.
Representative Springer, the experts that are referred to are the Department of Fish and Wildlife and Wildlife Services, which are the two agencies that confirm kills. And you know, we have brought in the county sheriff, the veterinarians. There are a number of different people that we can count on for doing necropsy work and discovering, you know, what is actually the culprit here. And if you look at the difference between a dog and a wolf track, it's significant. So hopefully that the experts, if you will, will make that call, and we're comfortable with it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Brings up a excellent point that I hadn't thought about, and this will probably be addressed in the rulemaking process that I think we as a body need to be very concerned about. Will a necropsy, an animal autopsy, will a necropsy be required for this? Because there's quite a cost there. So I think we need to be careful that it does not become, through the rulemaking process, cost prohibitive because a necropsy has been incorporated there. Because I bet you wouldn't pay for that if you had to do that to get the tax credit.
Representative Springer, the process from the rancher's perspective is we experience a kill, a dead animal. So the first person we would call would be ODF&W, then the sheriff, and sometimes that order is reversed, or Wildlife Services, or all three, boom, boom, boom. There is not always an agreement between those three, and so one says no, if you wouldn't mind an editorializing on my part, my opinion is that sometimes the decision can be political. So that if I look at a situation, it isn't always clear cut. A bull was killed on the same ranch last summer, and it was undeclared, and there was some very heightened emotion about this, and that took the bull about a week to pass away, and there were some very definite indications that probably it was some kind of a canine kill or a wolf kill, but it wasn't confirmed. So it's difficult to get confirmation, especially if the evidence. I'll give you an example. When the ground is frozen in Northeast Oregon, tracks are very difficult to tell. There was two kills. The parts were spread over 30 yards, and 12 people horseback. Only one set of horse tracks were detectable. there were no other tracks available, and so the conditions on the ground make it very difficult sometimes to come up for kill. We are only in the bill, and in the and in this we're only dealing with confirmed kills. So, and that would be where there is no doubt that the kill was attributable to a wolf, and that's what the bill asked for. That's what the compensation bill asked for. There are going to be a lot of people who will disagree that there are losses that are not confirmed or not probable, and so those losses are what they are. And so under the legislation that you passed last session and under this bill, those losses are only confirmed and probables are confirmed. And I don't even know that probables are discussed, but it discusses for sure confirmed kills. So I think, and that's a limiting factor. We're able at this point, that's what we are able to accept.
Yeah, confirmed. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative, for bringing that particular point up. I think that's a good point. And I think it should also be recognized by the committee. It wasn't the intention of the proposer that we discriminate against all other predators. The mountain lion, as an example, is still ever present in that part of our estate. We have a few that are seeking adoption to somewhere in Washington County, and we'd be willing to kind of facilitate that for folks if we could bring that about. But the witness has made some really excellent points, and it's something we don't have time for in this particular work session that we're in right now. But there's some amazing data. We talk about, and we're used to talking about the psychology of individuals. I mean, everybody kind of understands this. But there's some amazing data about what the impact is on the psychology of a herd of cattle that is being, if I can use the term, harassed by some kind of a predator. And he mentioned that some of that is you taking your own life in your hands when you go out. And since it's a wolf that has maybe been this predator, the herd dogs that these folks have that are that have been quite expensive for them, and have been very well trained, a very integral part of management of their herds, are being taken away from them because of the personality change that seems to be taking place in the herd. The other thing is the reproductive rate. There is, I wouldn't go so far as to call it good scientific studies at this particular point, but there's some very good data that I've seen and been, at the presentation where this was presented, some very good data that there is a significant decline in the birth rate of these herds that are being harassed by by wolves. And this bill doesn't even start to get at that. If you lose 10%, of your, that's a significant item for a rancher. A rancher, lives and survives based on this reproductive rate. And so the wolf may not even get dinner, and still have an impact, a significant impact here. And we're not even there yet in trying, to deal with that. And I wouldn't be here trying to introduce legislation for that,
until we have what I would determine or what I would feel were valid scientific studies of that. I am hopeful that somewhere down in the next legislative session, Representative, that the co-chairs would be looking at having some of this data presented to you just for some additional knowledge about you know, what's going on with the cattle herds in this state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we sort of need to move along.
Quick question.
So, Representative Johnson.
Is there a, what process do you have in mind for determining the value of the kills, whether it's a cow or a calf or whatever? Is there an objective way that everybody can agree on what the value of an animal is?
Representative Johnson, there are two ways to do that, in my opinion. One is the current value of that animal at the time of death.
Right.
That's very verifiable. That calves weigh, have a weight, or a cow has a value at that time. The other way to look at it is the eventual sale price of the calves. If you have an average at the end of the season, you wean calves that weigh an average amount, and the value of those, that average amount, you may have, if it's a 500-pound average, you might have calves that weigh 6 and calves that weigh 4, but you had an average of 5. And so that's a different way to look at it, saying if that calf were not killed and he lived to weaning, he would be worth, he would weigh 500 pounds, or an average of 500 pounds, and be worth X. Or you could say at the time of death, he weighed 200 and he was worth X. That's to be determined. A cow has a value as a pregnant cow, she's worth X. Sure. As a cull cow, she's worth X. Mm-hmm. So those are very verifiable numbers within the weight range.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Last question, Co-Chair Esquivel.
Oh, no, that's fine. My three can wait, and they're something I'd like you to think about as a... And that is, should we do away with the fund we currently have to replace it with this? The other thing is, in compensation, does anyone else compensate other than the state? And the third thing is that we want to adopt this, I think, in order to get it on the table so we can ask such questions at a later date.
Yeah, I agree.
So, and I think you'll want to check out on page 2, section 4, and we'll need to understand when it describes that the person can only take a credit for the amount that's left after already receiving compensation, is that just the wildlife fund that we have set up, or is it also any payments made by X or Y, or a tax deduction they're taking also as a business loss?
We need to sort that out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I should note, there's no guarantee this bill wouldn't go straight to revenue potentially. So if we don't see you again, you'll know that we got it on its way. Thank you for coming.
Thank you to the committee. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Was there anyone else here who missed? Did you folks want to testify on this one? I wasn't sure if you're here for this one. Okay. Anybody else? All right. Good. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing. Public hearing on House Bill LC. On LC 89, and open a public hearing on LC 90. And Jim and Doris, do you want to come up and quickly run us through a bill that we've already seen before, and
it was
predated on by some thing. Somebody predated this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, co-chair, I am here today representing the Association of Oregon Counties on LC 90, which is a bill that came before this committee, was passed out of this committee, passed out of the House, and went to the Senate, and didn't get referred any further. So we're trying again. The bill is about just two things in LC 90. It's about requiring the Department of Fish and Wildlife to consult with affected cities and counties on economic impacts of decisions that they propose protecting endangered species, and then also working with those affected cities and counties to mitigate the adverse impacts on local economies as the plan for protection moves forward. The Association of Counties really believes that this is just a good government bill, the way we ought to operate all state agencies, frankly. And the Department of Fish and Wildlife, they're great people, but their statute doesn't really require them to go through a process that we believe that they should have with local governments, just to be sure that they do their job, local governments do their job. So that's what this bill is about. The bill does not have any language change from
last session.
So I'm very happy to answer any questions.
Let's do Jim first, and then...
Chair Clem and Chair Esquivel, thank you for bringing this up again. And I had a great opportunity last Friday to sit with four counties, judges and commissioners in Harney County, and we were talking about this, wolves and some other things that were really economically impacting the counties. And, of course, what Judge Grassley and I have talked about this, and we gave testimony during the session in support of this bill also. And so many times, you know, and
Jim,
knowing...
Sorry, could you identify yourself?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Jim Welch, yeah. Oregon Cattleman, a lobbyist. And so many times we have not been able to talk about the economic impact to cities and counties and to private individuals, as you just heard from the past president of the Oregon Cattlemen, talking about those economic impacts on species that have been listed. And so we need that. We need it drastically, and especially at the Federal Endangered Species Act and at our own Oregon Endangered Species Act. So this is a great opportunity to have those discussions before something is listed as threatened or endangered. We need to. And we need to be talking about what it is to the private business or landowner also. So we are very much in support of this.
Great. Okay. Any questions? We've been through this one many times. Thank you for coming. I will tell you, having grown up in a city that had an endangered species listing, it certainly didn't feel like the federal government in any way worked with us to mitigate the adverse impacts, because it's still pretty adverse there.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, it's amazing we even have to have this bill. It should just automatically happen, and it ain't happening. It's unbelievable.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 90 and open a public hearing on LC 196. This is for Representative Jensen, who had given away his, he already used his bill, so we did the other bill, so it was a committee bill for at his request. This one, yours at least was relevant to the topic of this committee. This one clearly is not going to be coming to this committee, but it's mine, so I'll explain it to folks and wonder why in God's name is an ATM.
Is this because we get out-of-country buyers coming in to buy livestock, so they use their
the ATM
debit cards?
That's right. That's a stretch, but yeah. So the situation with this bill, that you won't see this again till the floor, I'm sure, unless you're on business and labor. Current law is that someone who owns an ATM, whether it's a bank or a mom and pop shop that owns them, they can charge you when you come and use their ATM because it's not your bank, and so they can charge you like $1.50 or whatever it is to use the thing at 7-Eleven that's owned by a private person. They're not allowed to charge foreign tourists who have their bank accounts in other countries a fee of any kind. So the domestic people pay the fee on behalf of the foreigners. I shouldn't call them foreigners. On behalf of the people who are here from outside the country who hold accounts in their other country, the rest of the domestic account holders pay for the foreign account holders' fee because they're not allowed to charge them. It'd be nice if this would just get solved federally, but unfortunately it's not happening. So the people who own ATMs around the country have been all going to their own respective states, asking their states to allow them to charge the foreign card holders a fee for using their cards. And it's passed now, I think, in like 22 or 23. We're somewhere now in the middle of someone who would do this until the feds act on it. It got brought to me by some people who own these ATMs and said it's kind of unfair that everybody else has to pay the fees and on behalf of these other folks. Sir, I can tell you firsthand, I pay a pretty hefty fee every time I take cash out in another country. It doesn't stop me from going there. I'm usually going there for some other reason, obviously, than just to use the ATM. So that's the bill. I told the folks, the mom and pops, don't even bother coming here. I'll explain it to the committee, and you can come once it's live and in front of the real committee that it would end up, because I figured it wasn't coming here.
Any questions for me? Representative Jensen.
Does that mean I should change my banking account to Canada?
Yeah, yeah. You could go to 7-Eleven and save the $2.50 if you do that.
Okay.
Until this bill makes its way through, potentially. Okay, that's all I've got on this one. I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 196. And I'm going to open. Yeah, I'm going to open a work session on all the other bills at once. Let me just rattle through this. Okay, open a work session on LCs 31, 32, 89, 90, and 196, which are all the ones we just did. Co-chair Esquivel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 31, dated December 9th, 2011. LC 32, dated January 17th, 2012. LC 89, dated December 6th, 2011. LC 90, dated December 16th, 2011. LC 196, dated December 12th, 2011.
Representative Esquivel moves that following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 31 dated December 9, 2011. LC 32 dated January 17, 2012. LC 89 dated December 6, 2011. LC 90 dated December 16, 2011. LC 196 dated December 12, 2011. Thank you.
Could you repeat that, please?
Any discussion? I already gave the caveat. That doesn't mean you like any of these bills or don't like them. This is just to move them forward to the February... what do we call this now? February session? February, it's no longer session. Supplemental or special. Just the February session. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, is there any objection? If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills. What's that?
Boone.
Oh, Representative Boone is excused.
I can't vote.
Right. She's not eligible to vote. So
you know what? If we were a joint committee, we could have. I hear that some of the Senate committees can, but it's a House rule.
Well, somebody one time voted over the phone, even though he only lives a mile from the Capitol, and it was a snow day, and someone may have ruined it for everybody else.
Someone?
Yeah, someone. It was a snowpocalypse that day.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we are doing LC 38, a public hearing. This is a member's bill. Why we're doing this and not doing it in the other batch is this doesn't need to be introduced by the committee because this is a member's bill. But the member, I think it's Representative Gilliam actually, he had requested that we, if we could, get some of the issues on the table now so the committee's familiar with them and it can help move it along more quickly in 10 days. So that's why we're doing this. LC 38, open a public hearing. And then... Roger, are you just having the other folks handle it? Okay, so Jim James, John Brees, and Chris Hefferman.
Good morning. Co-Chair Clem, Co-Chair Esquivel, and the rest of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you this morning about legislative concept 38, what we are calling the Wildfire Reduction Act. My name is Jim James. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. OSWA is an organization that represents the family forest landowners in the state of Oregon. Those are forest owners that own 5,000 acres or less of forest land. This bill, or this legislative concept, its intent is to, as the name implies, to reduce the amount of wildfires that we have in our state. The way we can accomplish that is provide the Oregon Department of Forestry additional funding in the areas of the state where fire risks are the highest. Those locations are Eastern Oregon, Hood River County, and Jackson and Josephine counties. In those areas, lightning strikes are more prevalent than any other areas of the state. In those areas, there's a large landowning neighbor called the U.S. Forest Service that has allowed their forests to degrade to a point that there is a very high risk of catastrophic fire. It's also a large area that makes it more complicated to detect and have initial attack on fires. It is the part of the state with the highest risk for forest fires, and history will document that that is an accepted fact. It's also an area where the current assessment to landowners is the highest of any other area in the state. To reduce the amount of fires we have in these high fire-prone areas, we need to have additional resources to detect and attack those fires. And we do not believe it's appropriate to ask landowners to come up with that additional funding. And the reason is that they already have the highest assessment of anywhere in the state. Those property owners, the timber values that they have enjoyed in the past are now gone. With the lack of timber sales from the Forest Service, many mills in eastern Oregon and in southwest Oregon have closed, and the infrastructure to transport logs to a facility has also decreased. So the value of the timber on those forests is no longer near the value that it was in the past. Also, the reclassification of grazing land in this area has added some inequity to how those lands are protected. And again, the fire program in Oregon has historically been based on equity of landowners in the general fund. And that equity is extremely important, one that we believe is still valuable. However, with the decreased value of forest lands in these areas, we now believe that the real benefactor of keeping those fires small is no longer the 50-50 split that we've historically experienced with landowners and the general public, the general fund. We believe that the ecological values and the safety values that are protected with fewer fires in these areas is actually a larger benefactor than the landowner who saves the value of his trees but don't have a lot of value. So we're suggesting that additional general fund dollars be allocated to the protection in these high fire district areas. And the bill actually talks about a 60-40 split. And it is not our intent that the landowner's cost would go down in this scenario. We believe that they have an obligation to pay for their fire cost. But we do believe this additional money to help reduce the number of costs and reduce everyone's costs in the state for fires should come from the general fund, because we believe they're truly the benefactors of this additional protection. There's also an element of the bill that would modify the way the emergency fire fund is funded. Currently, the emergency fire fund, landowners pay the first $10 million. General fund picks up the next 15. And in fact, in your my testimony, there's a couple of diagrams there that kind of show where the existing fire funding is and what the Wildfire Reduction Act fire funding could look like. And we believe that sharing in the first dollar of the emergency fire fund is a more equitable way to deal with that element. We're also suggesting that the $25 million deductible for our fire insurance policy, which landowners in the state share in 50-50, be dropped to $20 million instead of $25 million, which would actually give the general fund a $5 million less liability if those funds were ever needed. This is not a new issue. In the 2011 legislature, the Department of Forestry had a bill titled the Wildfire Reduction Act. It was our intent to mimic the intent that was in that bill. There's a huge problem that needs to be solved, and the landowners in these areas don't have the ability or cannot afford to solve it any more than their existing contribution. Therefore, additional revenues need to come from a new source. There is a committee that's trying to address this issue. It was at the direction of the Board of Forestry. I'm sitting on that committee. It is likely that the model that's in this legislative concept needs to be modified. And again, we started with the program that was initiated earlier. And one might ask the question, well, why would you not wait until this committee completes its work? Why are you in a rush? We have a short session. Why not wait till 2013? And my response to that is, when your house is on fire, you don't wait around for a convenient time to go put it out. And this is an extremely important issue. The landowners in these areas are at their limits of what they can afford, and their land is in jeopardy of a catastrophic fire that they actually have no way to protect themselves against. And we believe this is a very urgent issue that needs to be addressed now. And again, I would also repeat myself, this may not be the perfect scenario at this time in this legislative concept, but I believe that that we, within the realm of time we have to work in, and particularly if we take advantage of some efforts that are going on, that we could come up with the right answer and get this process started. We anticipate an implementation, not immediately, but in the next biennium. And one of our motives to push this issue forward now is that we would like it to be in the governor's next biennium budget. We would prefer that the legislature not be trying to figure out a way where to find the money that's going to fund this activity. We would rather it already be on everybody's radar screen, and so it can be addressed properly. I think I'll stop there. I would again like to thank the committee for hearing these comments, for seriously considering, I hope, this legislative concept. Again, a couple of OSWA members who are landowners on the east side are going to make some additional comments. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm John Brees from Prineville, Oregon. That's in Cook County. Representative Mike McLean's our representative, and our senators, Doug, our ranch is near Post, Oregon, and if you were to draw lines, it would be the geographical center of the world as we know it. Probably my best talk will be on the drive home. I'm not particularly good at coming before groups. The last time that Chris and I were on a program together was in the early or mid 80s. We were both given awards for stewardship for Department of Forestry and Department of Fish and Wildlife. Also, as aside, as most of these programs this morning, bills on our ranch, we could address most of those if anybody wanted to know what we had to say. But I'm supporting the Wildlife Reduction Act, and what's happening to us is in the last 10 years, the assessment for forestry is on an upward trend. It used to be before that, if we had a good fire season, the assessment went down. We had a bad fire season, the assessment went up, but it was fairly stable, and now it's on an upward trend that's becoming it's becoming a problem when you're looking at your bottom line. On our property tax, the assessment is over 90% now, and that's significant. Our ranch has been in the family since 1888. We're fourth generation ranchers, and it's our plan, if the state gets out of our way, to pass that down to a younger set of cousins that really want to ranch. Historically, timber on East Central Oregon ranches was not a value. My grandfather and my dad and my uncle, well, my grandfather especially, we raised sheep right after the sheep wars in Central Oregon, and the trees were just getting in the way of seeing where the sheep were. They trailed sheep from Central Oregon to Diamond Lake and then up into the up near Burns. So they all through the war years, that's what we did, and then we went into the cattle business because of no sheep herders, and you couldn't trail sheep through Bend anymore. As in the cattle business, then things changed a little bit. And in the 1970s, my Uncle Jerry was on the board of forestry, and that got us to thinking a little bit differently. Prior to that, if a logger, the mills came by and said, well, here's a check, take the timber, and we did. But the Department of Forestry, Jim Brown was a service forester and became the state forester. His idea was maybe we ought to start looking at thinning and working with Central and Eastern Oregon properties, and we've been interested in that since 1986. And when my father passed away, Lynn and I now are running our part of the ranch, and we thought that timber should be an important part, and it was, and it is an important part of our operations. It's integral in how we can do business. However, these timber prices are really dropped. It's harder to log. We have a log truck, and it's not economic to go. We can't haul logs to Gilchrist and economically. We can't haul logs to John Day and make it pay just in the trucking costs, even if it's our own truck. All of Eastern Oregon is having these problems. The other thing is that with the assessment is, the Department of Forestry has, they've always said that they're pretty transparent about their budgets, but when you get down to the district level, that it's very, it's more complex than you might think, and I admire you to look at that budget and try to understand it, because the more you get into it, the more little weasels and unintended consequences come out. But when it comes to us in Central Oregon and in Eastern Oregon too, those budgets are gotten too high for us to be able to support. And when we have given our disapproval to these budgets, the Department of Forestry said you're going to pay them anyway, and so many of those costs are beyond our ability to have anything to do with it. The personnel costs, salaries, PERS, all administrative costs are stuck in there, and if we want to make any changes, it's like, what's your level of, what kind of level can you bring that down to? In other words, how many engines do you want to cut out of our budget, and we're unwilling we can't really do that. We're stuck because we as landowners are. We're responsible for the protection of our forest, and it always comes back down to us in the very end. So, if we're wanting to lower those costs, we can. And if we want a green forest, we have to have those costs. And at this point, you can't. Using cowboy math anyway, you can't plant a tree and grow it out and harvest it in 60 to 80 years and pay the assessment through those 60 years. It won't pay out. So at the end, you're looking at this younger generation, you know, this ranching for profit, where they're looking at, okay, is this part of the ranch paying its way? And when you look at the forest part of it, it's not paying its way. So what are we, you know, what are we going to do if the state says, oh, we want timber from now and through, you know, more generations and future, and we can't get there from here and pay these kinds of fire costs. It's almost like, well, a friend had timberland up in the Sumter area. A forest fire came off the national forest and took out his forest, and he didn't harvest that. He allowed it to go away and fall down, and now he can grow, you know, better grass there because it's a higher grass site, and actually makes more money than if he were on that part of his ranch. He's making more money grazing cattle than he is growing trees. And so people are looking at that and saying, well, you know, maybe we ought to change our way of forest management. Maybe we ought to be looking at other ways of using that land. And it's getting to that critical point where people are saying, oh, let's really look at how, you know, let's look at these bottom lines. I hope you read our statement. It's probably a little bit more clear. We need some certainty. I think every business needs certainty of how they can do business, and that's why we're asking this, that there are a lot of options, but this option that's on the table, the 60% by the general public and 40% by us, is more reasonable. It bridges that gap between what we think was sustainable and what the law or the public is demanding. If you want those kind of things of clean water, clean air, and a pleasing environment out there in Central and Eastern Oregon, then this is a way to get it. If you start now, it gives us a way to plan into the future. So thank you very much for letting me talk.
You bet. And you're a co-recipient of a 1980-something award here. We're anxiously awaiting.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Chris Heffernan, and thank you for this opportunity to come speak in front of you guys over here on the west side. I'm a private landowner from Northeast Oregon, North Powder, kind of a little modern-day ghost town between Baker and LeGrand. It's a working ranch. It's very diverse. We have timberlands. We run cattle. We have a farm that we raise irrigated alfalfa and winter wheat, barley, cereal grains, and hay forage crops for Idaho dairies, Oregon dairies, Washington dairies, as well as the cattlemen in our region. We also have a custom hay and business in a North Slope Natural Resource company that we help private landowners as well as the federal government manage timber and wildlife on their properties through appointments that we get from the U.S. Forest Service. Well, Whitman National Forest. We border the public lands, our home ranch does. You know, we were talking about wetlands and wolves and stuff prior. You know, we're fortunate in our country. We have a lot of things, including the wetlands, which is a blessing, you know, out there in Northeast Oregon. We've got the wolf too, maybe not so much of a blessing, but it's there. But we are very proud and very fortunate to have the land base that my wife and I bought back in 92. I mean, talk about God bless America. It was a great opportunity. And Oregon overall has been very good to us. But it's diminished. severely over the last 20 years that we've been there. The one thing we have that's a lot more important to me than the wolf or the wildlife or the wetlands, which all have their values, and I'm kind of rattling on here. I was appointed by John Kitzhoffer, Governor John Kitzhoffer, back in 90. It was, I guess I was interviewed in 99 and appointed in 2000, or it might have been 2000 appointed in 2001, and had the honor to serve on the Board of Forestry to represent Eastern Oregon for 7 years. But the one thing that the governor and I do believe had in common was the value of human life and the quality of life, over and above everything else. And I was kind of considered an unknown wild card from northeastern Oregon, and that might still be true today, or it might be right on that we're just working to try to get people back together to start taking care of one another. The one thing rare, back to the wolf and the wetlands, rare that we have on our place today that a lot of other neighbors don't have is the next generation. We have two sons that graduated from ag school with business degrees and production degrees, and we leveraged the home place, the timberland, because it was appraised on recreational values, not the true values of what timber and grazing is worth today in our part of the state. But it did put us in a position to leverage it into a couple thousand more acres to build a farm, an irrigated farm. We took a dry land farm and we drilled water wells and went through the process with water resources, and it was all really good up until our partner that we thought we had in 2009 called the bank, and everything went south, and all of a sudden we were treated like second-class citizens, and we weren't alone. It was everybody, and I'm not blaming the local community banks. It was the way the whole situation went, but it's been really tough times. But our sons have learned a lot by seeing what Mom and Dad has gone through and how hard we fought, you know, for and believed in the land and the resources that we provide. I'm going to switch gears here really quick and get on to the real issues in today, and that's the fire, and that's the concerns of a lot of our neighbors that maybe don't have a custom hand business or a resource business to supplement the timberland because it won't support itself. These land bases are expensive, and you have to keep healthy forests healthy or you're going to end up losing them to either insect disease or catastrophic fire, whether it starts on you or your neighbor that's not managing, being the public lands. So some of our neighbors are even thinking at this point to get out of the, they'd like to buy out of the, you know, the state's protection. I mean, it's just, they've crunched the numbers, especially the grazing. It's really tough on some of these guys. And we're not exempt, believe me. But I think that'd be a tragedy because the relationship we have, and I am the chairman for the Fire Budget Committee for Northeastern Oregon, and we're like a band of brothers and sisters when it comes to us landowners. And the work we do with the Department of Forestry, I got to praise them. These guys are our cavalry. These guys, on the initial attack, we keep small fires small. We don't mess around with them. And what we're looking for here today is if we can get some more support on the front end and a little relief with our taxes. Mine's 87% of my tax is the fire protection. The rest of it goes to the other county needs. But if we could move this money into initial attack, we can keep these fires down instead of getting these catastrophic fires that cost all of us, especially the state and us landowners, a huge amount. So, I mean, this thing could pay back the state, you know, I mean, in spades. It's a good deal. It's a good deal for all of us. It's a win deal. Or, to be honest with you, people like us wouldn't stand up here or sit up here and take your time up. But the bottom line is I want to give, like I said, credit to the state Department of Forestry, working with us local landowners. And after 7 years on the board and being in every corner of this great state, I can say confidently that all these agencies in the Department of Forestry are working very closely with people like us. And we need to keep ourselves together, not get it fragmented by people trying to find other options to survive and buy out of it. We're a good group. And when we show up to fires, and I'm talking about the Department of Forestry, when they show up on our lands, more public lands, they are well-respected by law enforcement, by the U.S. Forest Service, by Rural Fire Department, by our, you know, the State Highway Department, everybody. And these people are truly patriots in our community. You know, it's really easy to come over here and, you know, once or twice a year, because I'm not on the board anymore, which is fine, to you know, represent some kind of modern-day John Wayne's, especially with the fellow that spoke before us. But you guys are the true patriots in the community that in the trenches day in and day out. And we salute you guys. I think you're in a good spot with today's world of change to make a difference.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, we are.
Just for the record, I want you to know that we shipped our wolf down south to California.
I read about that. Nancy Pelosi can have it, right?
That's right.
Okay, thank you very much. We've got one more person who signed up to testify, too, that would like to testify. And then we've got our folks from the Gorge who all came in this morning are all here, too, ready to go. I'm late. So I'm not going to take any questions at this point unless it just has to happen for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for recognizing.
Well, it does. Representative Jensen.
I'm just more than a little bit interested in the 50-50 formula and the coming up with the 40-60, because it took a little closer look at the material when I recognized, before I recognized what you were asking for. I think you probably, or at least your lobbyists, would be very familiar with the 60-40, 50-50 debate that has taken place in the last two sessions of the legislature. And I know my good friend on my right here is deeply familiar with this through maybe not something of her choice to become familiar with. And I'm curious where you came up with the 60-40. I'm also curious if we take that as a whole body, a whole, you know, numbers, the total cost, what portion of that is going to be reduced, you know, with the east side versus the west side, or the high, as you say, the high lightning strikes are, you know, peculiar pretty much to the east central side of the state as far as costs and, you know, are concerned. Most of the fires are started by lightning strikes, you know, over there. And certainly there's a lot of, you know, early intervention which keeps those fires down to an acre, maybe, as contrasted to 30,000-40,000 acres, that if you don't have the early intervention, so the merits are certainly there for us. But I just wonder if you worked the numbers for me, because as I look at this, Mr. Chair, it becomes painfully aware that they're asking the Ways and Means to come up with a redistribution of how we figure the Forest Service budget and the fire budget, you know, on this. And so that will be a, you know, and you're aware that it was a difficult climb to get to holding it at 50-50.
Maybe.
And to reverse that and go the other way is going to be a difficult climb. I'm not disagreeing with your request or your, what you know what you're talking about. I'll be supportive of this, but I just need to really be well informed.
Yeah. Representative Jensen, great question. And certainly we're aware of the historical 50-50, 60-40, and how hard we've always fought to keep it to where the landlords aren't paying more. So we're very much aware of that. And we do know that the 60-40 does challenge some of the historical arguments of why it ought to be 50-50.
Yeah.
This is a unique situation here that's different than what we've dealt with before. I don't know that 60-40 is the right number, and since that's in the bill, maybe that's a strange thing to say. And I would probably speculate that once this was really evaluated, particularly with the group that the Department of Forestry is working on now, that a different solution will come up.
and we will be very supportive of that solution. Our bottom line is we think there's a huge problem there, and we have to find a solution. A likely solution is the manipulation of how fires are currently funded, which may require the general fund to pay for more in some areas and less than others. Great question. I wish I had a definitive answer. But I would admit that the way it's in this legislative concept is a little waffly, and it's something that we would hope to improve on. I don't know if that was a good answer or not, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate very much your indulging
me. Given you'll have to deal... Well, actually, you know, it's interesting. The way the bill's crafted, theoretically, someone could argue it doesn't even need to go to Ways and Means, but it should, obviously, because it would have ramifications that I think you and your partner there would both have strong opinions about.
Yeah, the bill wouldn't have to go to Ways and Means, but if it's passed and becomes law, it will come back to Ways and Means because it will mean redistribution of the money that goes to the Department of Forestry.
Right. Which may mean the co-speakers send it there anyway, whether we like it or not. Okay. Thank you so much for traveling so
thank
far,
you.
Too.
Yeah.
You bet.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your being here.
So, Nancy, Christina, and Mike. Christina and Mike, I'm looking for massive brevity from you two. But, Nancy, you're our respondent here from the other half of the payer equation a little bit, and so let's hear from Nancy first.
Good morning, Chair Quinn, Co-Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hirsch, Chief of the Fire Protection Division for Oregon Department of Forestry. I believe you will have a letter in front of you here shortly. In that letter, I really attempted to provide a brief bit of context on really two fronts, really Oregon's, the department's fire policy, and secondly, currently how Oregon firefighting protection is funded in Oregon. In the interest of time, I will have you review that on your own and maybe just pick up where Mr. James spoke to you about the Wildfire Reduction Act, the act that the department introduced in the previous two biennia. That act, when the department introduced it, included components to add capacity at the base level of protection, and that's really the fire department. Secondly, it attempted to maintain the severity resources, and of course, you're probably all very familiar with that. We receive those resources through the special purpose appropriation, and they're very critical for us keeping fires small, reducing costs, and the associated resource loss. Thirdly, it also developed equity policy in the large fire costs between the general fund and the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. To date, that proposal has not made it into the governor's recommended budget. So as a result of that, the department went to the Board of Forestry in September of 2011 and made a recommendation to convene a statewide committee to come up with some alternative solutions to address these challenges of which you've heard about previously here today. So that committee is represented or comprised of forest landowners throughout the state, a member of the Board of Forestry, other stakeholders, also representative from the governor's office. Details on the membership are included in Attachment B in your hands there. The committee was formed to address two key objectives. I think you're very familiar with those from the earlier testimony. But again, the objectives are to reduce the number of large fires, which basically minimizes the cost of fire suppression and also reduces the amount of resource loss. Secondly, the committee objective is to address the funding dilemma, which again was talked about, where we have these high fire occurrences in certain districts, but we also have some of the lowest productivity lands in those districts. The committee first met in November, again in December, and at its third meeting this week, the committee will be reviewing and refining alternatives. That meeting will occur this week. Discussions to date, I guess I would like to emphasize, there's a deep understanding by members on that committee of the current economic situation that the state is in, as well as these forest landowners and those that also own grazing lands. As a result of that, the ideas that have emerged and to date have gained some traction are ones that essentially consider a phased-in approach, particularly on that large fire equity piece of the previously introduced bill. Ideas on the table for discussion this week include ones that address the grazing lands, the ratios at the base level of protection, additional investment of severity resources. Those are those severity resources that I mentioned earlier that, again, are very critical in terms of our ability of keeping fires small. Resources that we utilize right now in that category include 2 air tankers and 3 helicopters that are statewide in nature. And lastly, again, as I mentioned, ideas that the committee will be discussing this week are the restructuring of that insurance deductible, but again, over time with a phased-in approach. Following the February meeting, which is the last meeting of this Fire Protection Funding Committee, the department will be taking a recommendation in terms of a legislative concept to the Board of Forestry at its March meeting. I would also emphasize that this committee is very passionate, very dedicated, and landowners throughout the state, we're getting emails constantly or phone calls, coming up with a lot of creative ideas and solutions for us to debate and discuss within that working group. So I really have appreciated the dedication of the landowners involved in that, as well as the various stakeholders. I also note a website in the letter there. We try to keep that very up to date. And I would also offer, if any of you have additional questions or would like to spend some time one-on-one, myself as well as the other department co-convener of the committee, who is Paul Bell, the deputy state forester, both of us or one of us would be happy to meet with you. So thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Christina.
Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chairs Clemon and Esquivel. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt with the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and with me to my far right is Mike Dykesel, also with the council, and the guy who has all the numbers. I think he sleeps with him.
Super brevity. You two missed the sign-up.
Super short.
Deal, so
I'd like to bring this up to the 60,000-foot level instead of kind of delving into the details. But this committee is a little more sophisticated on fire funding. Particularly, you have benefited from having the 2 of the 3 tri-chairs of the subcommittee of Ways and Means dealing with this issue, and you have heard for years and years and years about 50-50, equity 50-50. And I think what this whole legislative concept brought forward by OSWA is all about is recognizing that despite the heroic efforts of the Ways and Means subcommittee to get the base level of fire protection at 50-50, and you'll recall last session the governor's recommended budget started at a shift onto landowners at 45-55. So that was recovered at 50-50. But what is often overlooked by the larger legislative community, not this committee or certainly not Ways and Means, is that the fire funding piece is based on 3 primary building blocks. It's the base fire protection, which is at 50-50, and thank you very, very much. And then there's the cost of severity, and there's the cost of large fires. Within those other 2 blocks, it's kind of complicated all the revenue streams. But what we're talking about really, and what this committee is going to be talking about and bringing forward recommendations, is how do we get to that elusive 50-50 in those other pieces. And I'll pass out a graph, but basically since 1993, the landowner portion of the quote-unquote 50-50 in suppressing large fire and paying for large fire costs is 82%, and the state general fund has been 18%. So landowners are in it at $156,887 million. That does not even count for their lost resources in timberland values, and it certainly doesn't account for the public values lost in fires, which ruins habitats, healthy streams, water quality, air quality. We can go on and on. So I just would like to say the reason, and I'm not meaning to speak for OSWA, but I think part of the reason this bill is introduced in front of you today is to capture an opportunity that may come forward from this Board of Forestry work group that will be concluding its work and making recommendations at the end of February, and maybe there's a way to capture those recommendations, put them into the shell of this bill without a funding mechanism, but an enacting opportunity so that it's built into the governor's budget the next time around. So we have a lot of work to do between now and February 22nd. Anyway, we will be back to you, but that's why we're in front of you. This is a very, very pressing issue. Appreciate a lot that both Lynn and John Breeze and Donna and Chris Heffernan came from Eastern Oregon. Their stories are real, and they're in pain, and we need to keep productive forest lands in productive use. Thank you.
Thanks.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Mike Deichsel, Director of Forest Protection for OFIC. What I've passed out to you folks maybe supports John and Chris's descriptions, verbal descriptions, on what fire patrol assessments have done. The charts that were sent out basically depict three different districts and the rather large increases in fire protection costs as compared to consumer price index. The one on the bottom is a West Side, West Oregon district that kind of shows basically, while it has been increasing, it's been relatively close. The second chart is the collective of all 12 forest protection districts as compared to consumer price index, and there's a lot of different factors that are embedded in that with fire cost inflation. Don't need to speculate on all of them. And then on the final page, as one of those points that John Breeze pointed out, costs that are outside of our control, one of them, which I believe very strongly influences that unnecessary increase in annual assessments, are, just for one example, state government service charges. This is a document that shows through 95 through the 09-11 biennium what the changes to state government service charges have been, and just jumps off the page at you at the kind of influence that has. And that's my comments.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 38, open our informational hearing on the Columbia Gorge Scenic Compact Act, etc., and ask Jill and Jeff to please come up.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I hope the Board of Forestry doesn't tweak the rules messing with private woodland owners. I've been reading about that in the paper. That's about to scare me to death.
I did read about it.
Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Kellen has to be excused.
I would just like to apologize to the next group of presenters. I have back-to-back committees, that, and I'm chairing the next one. So.
Yeah, no problem.
Sorry.
Not you.
Co-chair Clement Esquivel.
Thanks for driving in this morning. Sorry about the rush on time.
It's all right. Yep. Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senator, and staff. I'm Jill Ahrens, Executive Director of the Columbia River Gorge Commission. With me today is Jeff Litwack, who is counsel for the Gorge Commission, Jennifer Ball Caden, our lead senior planner, is safe in the gorge, so we're glad that she didn't have to make this trip with the snow the way it is. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today about the Gorge Commission, the scenic area, and the compact that created the agency. I'd like to give you some historical background about the Act and the Commission, tell you about our legal status that is unusual, to say the least, and then tell you a little bit about what the Gorge Commission does. Some of the galvanizing events that led to the passage of the Scenic Area Act were a series of subdivision proposals in Skamania County. All of these would have been visible from Multnomah Falls and the highway, with several million visitors coming to those places and many millions of dollars in tourism possible from those sites as well. The gorge, even before that, though, was subject to protection efforts for decades before that. The initial bill for this was to create a national park, with a federal agency that would take control of the entire area. But since we do have a unique land base, we have half of the scenic area in private ownership. So this was not going to work. There's no national park or forest or scenic area that has any communities in it, and this part of the gorge has had communities for over 12,000 years. So this was an integral part of this land. Dual protections that we have of resource protection and economic development are not new ideas, but they are complex, and it requires a balance of both, as you already know. Tourism and recreational activities, for instance, require that the landscapes be protected from overdevelopment, and the communities need the leeway to provide services and products to these residents and visitors who come. People and companies have been moving to the gorge because of the protections. Several people have vacationed in the gorge, happen to be CEOs of companies, and have moved their companies to the gorge because of the lifestyle, the beauty, the recreation, and the fact that they can begin their companies or have other sites of their companies. Google is one. It has 125 people in Wasco County right now. So going back to the initial efforts of a national park, that was not going to work. In an alternative to that nationally controlled area was a state-based solution or an interstate compact. This interstate compact is a three-legged stool with Oregon, Washington, and Congress. It is not just a two-legged stool with among the states, and I think this is one of the key components of this compact for the Gorge Commission. So the compact created the Gorge Commission, and we were charged as the land use agency with both purposes of the act, the resource protection and economic development that is consistent with resource protection. So the solution was a compromise, again, with the local control to the states and the counties. The states and counties appoint their own local appointee representatives to the Gorge Commission. Along with the passage of the act came $10 million were authorized for construction of a conference center that is now Skamania Lodge, and an interpretive center, which is the Gorge Discovery Center. There was another $10 million authorized for recreational facilities and improvement, and $2.5 million for the historic Columbia River Highway. Lastly, there was about $10 million authorized for economic development. And that would be available for any counties that have adopted their own scenic area ordinance, so that it was an incentive to adopt the ordinance. The Oregon Investment Board administers these funds, and they provide either grants or revolving loans to people in the area to create and maintain jobs or to diversify the economy. To date, the Oregon Investment Board, with this initial investment of $4 million, which is what Oregon has received, has provided $6.7 million in additional loans because of the revolving nature of the funds. They've leveraged $13 million in private funds and $12 million in public funds also with these monies. Economic studies from Oregon Tourism show that Oregon counties of Hood River and the northern part of Wasco received $131 million in tourism spending in 2010. Contributing about 1,800 jobs for this industry or industry cluster. And for rural communities, this is a very significant impact in a positive way. There was also over $5 million in state and local tax receipts. The scenic area articulated its purposes and standards. The four resources that are to be protected are the scenic, natural, cultural, and recreation resources. The regional economy, or the regional economies within the gorge, are to be protected in ways that maintain the rural landscape. So, in addition to forest lands, ag lands, and open spaces, they are to be protected. These are similar to Oregon's goals, but they are not the same. They're similar to Washington's, but they are not the same. Again, these were compromises created by the states and Congress before 1986, calling this out as a special management area. The responsibilities that the Gorge Commission has, again, were agreed to by the two states and Congress. They're twin statutes in the states that mirror the compact language and support the Gorge Commission's work according to the Act. I'll turn to Jeff Litwack now. He has several comments about the development of the management plan.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the Commission, my name is Jeff Litwack. I'm counsel to the Columbia River Gorge Commission. Initially, Jill gave me this task of talking about the management plan because she didn't want me going on and on about the complexities of the National Scenic Area and the relationship between the states and the federal government. However, if you have questions about that, I'm more than happy to talk about it. In fact, I do better responding to your questions than hoping that what I have to say today is what you really want wanted from us. Nevertheless, Director Ahrens asked me to speak about the management plan and how the commission developed it. I am currently the second longest serving staff member on the commission. I first joined the commission in 1992, which was right after the commission adopted the management plan. I did have a 5-year hiatus to go to law school and then work for Multnomah County. I'm now back with the Gorge Commission. So Director Ahrens mentioned in her comments that the Scenic Area Act articulated standards for the management plan that are different than the Oregon Land Use Planning Program and that are different from the Washington Growth Management Act. When writing the plan, the commission and the Forest Service, and the U.S. Forest Service actually writes a portion of the plan, the commission and the Forest Service had to look at multiple sources. It looked at Oregon law, it looked at Washington law, federal law, standards that tribal governments had enacted for tribal lands. It looked to best practices in counties. It looked to best practices around the country. The commission did not simply adopt what others had done. And there is a reason for that, and that is the scenic area is different. As Director Ahrens explained, it is a mishmash of federal and private, state and tribal lands. It also had to respond to the different direction in the Scenic Area Act than the two states' land use planning statutes and really any other state land use planning statute in the country. So the commission had to adapt what it investigated to fit within the National Scenic Area. In some instances, the commission had to craft its own unique standards to address situations that were really unparalleled elsewhere in the country. I think I need to give you a few examples. First, the commission borrowed, this is in the early 90s, the then $40,000 income test for farm dwellings that came from Oregon land use regulations. However, Oregon updated its test to $80,000 in the late 90s. The commission did not follow. The commission determined that the farms in the gorge were more of farms in the size around dozens of acres instead of hundreds or thousands of acres. And so the size of the farms and the types of crops that were being produced in the gorge led themselves to a lower standard than elsewhere in the state of Oregon. A second example, the commission adapted the federal law standards for significance of archaeological objects, traditional cultural properties, and historic buildings. However, more recently, the commission developed a unique set of standards for allowing landowners who have historic buildings on their property to reuse those buildings for uses that would provide income to the landowners. The caveat being that the landowners had to develop a plan to show how the The new uses that would be in those historic buildings would then help lead to the preservation of those historic buildings. This was done in consultation with others around the country who had similar programs, but more importantly with the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And my third example, and my last one, is about ag land in particular. Like Oregon and like Washington, the National Scenic Area Act protects ag land for ag purposes and forest land for forest purposes. But again, unlike Oregon and unlike Washington, there's this separate set of standards in the Scenic Area Act that require certain uses to protect the scenic, cultural, natural, and recreation resources in the gorge. Hence, there are some uses that Oregon allows outright on farmland that simply cannot be allowed outright in the scenic area. They require some type of review and approval. The use that we call horse boarding facilities is an example of this. The management plan allows horse boarding facilities on ag land. We understand that it's an agricultural use in Washington, and that was part of the commission's deliberations. However, it is also a commercial type use, and in order to avoid a conflict with the Scenic Area Act, the management plan had to provide some type of review and approval for those facilities to protect the scenic, cultural, natural, and recreation resources of the gorge. That's all I have. I welcome your questions. So thank you for your time.
So thank you. On that last point, when you say had to, you mean the federal act requires conditional, well, some type of review, and if you were going to go to an outright statute like Oregon has, you'd actually change federal law to not require a review by the commission?
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Sure. Yep. Yep. And some people may leave. We've got just a few. I was able to get the room for an extra 10 minutes so we can finish. But some committee members may have other things they're supposed to get to, myself probably included, but I'm staying. So, sorry, my time management wasn't great today, so I apologize for rushing in.
Could you email that to each one of us, that authorization on that last point?
I'm happy to, and I can certainly provide your staff with a citation to the federal authority.
Okay.
She'll get
We're going to hear from a couple other folks, but essentially just from a legal standpoint, if we want to make changes to the management plan at all, it involves Washington agreeing, it involves it not being in conflict with the federal act, otherwise they also have to be changed all simultaneously, and it sounds like it probably changes the nature a little bit of who currently changes the, like that's largely been delegated to the commission. If the legislature started telling our half of the commission at least what to do, that would change some of the existing authority that's sort of in play now. Like our option was to appoint a commission, and then the commission went and negotiated and a plan with the two sides. It's a little bit confusing. Did the legislatures have to come back and ratify the plan, or once it created the commission has its own authority to create a plan as long as it's within compliance of the federal Scenic Act?
So what happened was in 1986, the Congress enacted this National Scenic Area Act. The National Scenic Area Act was actually hashed out by representatives from both governor's offices and the four Northwest senators' offices. They hold themselves up in Stevenson, Washington for a weekend and basically came out with a legislative proposal to go to Congress that is remarkably similar to what we have today. There are a few words that have been changed. So that was enacted in 1986. And then between 1987 and 1991, the Gorge Commission and the Forest Service jointly developed the management plan. And then in 2004, the Gorge Commission and the Forest Service amended the management plan because every 10 years we're required to do a comprehensive review of the plan and then determine if it needs to be revised. So the next revision cycle will need to be coming up. Hopefully we'll have the staff and the resources to take that on in a timely manner. So it is up to the commission to do the work in developing and amending the management plan.
And we had an original bill draft submitted that had the legislature saying, well, this is what we want in it. And the council came back and said, yeah, you really can't do that. That's not really, you already gave that power away at some point. So that's part of what we're talking about is if we want to suggest to the commission, since that seems to be the only tool, how to modify it, what is the right venue for us to do something like that? A resolution, having hearings like this and explaining our points about various things that the next speaker is going to talk about.
And I will provide your staff with a copy of a US GAO report from 2007. This committee and the Oregon legislature are not the only folks who are concerned with good government practices and overseeing interstate compact agencies. Senator Assemblyman Leslie in California in about 2005 had the same concerns and actually got the US GAO to do a study of accountability in interstate compact agencies. And so that report, it's publicly available. Again, I'll provide that to your staff. Okay, so there is a measure of that oversight that happens as a natural, we're a government agency, so it simply happens.
Okay, thank you, and thanks for driving in.
Thank you.
And Dave and Richard, who have been hashing all this out in the audience, I presume, too. So let's hear your plan.
So can you train dogs on farmland in the scenic area?
No.
By conditional permit. Park human beings,
either.
Of log trucks.
Can you park log trucks?
Yeah. Did that make it all the way through it?
Oh, man.
I think it died in the Senate.
Dave. Co-Chairs Clam and Esquivel, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, thanking you for the opportunity to appear at this hearing to talk about what I think is an important issue. I'll give you the backstory as to why, how we became involved in this, and then move forward to what is the bigger picture, and do it so with brevity. I received a call from a property owner in East Multnomah County, probably in Representative Johnson's district, who wanted to board horses in a ag zone. And was running into all kinds of trouble with Multnomah County, asked what he could do, and I thought, well, this is strange. Boarding horses is a farm use under Oregon law. He's in an ag zone. Mm-hmm. Encouraging farmers to farm in an agricultural zone is sort of the underlying premise behind Senate Bill 100. So why is the county treating this as a conditional use? This is an outright permitted use. Upon further study, discovered that he was subject to the provisions of the National Scenic Act, or the Gorge Scenic Act, excuse me, that he was subject to the provisions of the management plan, and that the management plan had a definition of agricultural use that was different than the definition of farm use in state law. I then approached the two co-chairs and said, well, maybe we can draft a bill that requires the Gorge Commission to treat farm uses as outright permitted uses in ag zones the way they are in, I don't know, every other county outside of Wasco, Hood River, portions of Wasco, Hood River, and Multnomah counties that are subject to the National Scenic Act. Got a call then from Ledge Council saying, well, I'm not sure we can do this. Did some further research, and unfortunately, I think that's probably correct. I'm not sure at this point that the legislature has the authority through legislation to force the Gorge Commission to adopt amendments to the management plan, which is, in my mind, very significant. We have large portions of those three counties counties within the NSA. The management plan governs land uses in those areas. There are literally thousands of private property owners within those three counties who are subject to the management plan, and essentially the management plan is the land use document. It's not LCDC's goals. It's not state statute. It's the Gorge Commission's management plan. And in my mind, there's no reason why a farmer in Wasco County should be treated differently from a farmer in Marion County. But unfortunately, that's the system that we have in place. While I doubt very much that the legislature has the authority to enact a piece of legislation that requires a direct amendment to the management plan, that doesn't mean that the legislature isn't prohibited from taking further action. As the previous speakers discussed, the legislatures of Washington and Oregon in 1987 enacted the Gorge Compact. The Gorge Compact is essentially a contract between Oregon and Washington. It was blessed in advance by the act itself, and gave the two state legislatures the ability to create the contract between the two of them that formed the commission and governed the activities of the commission. So the commission is governed by the terms of the compact entered into between Washington and Oregon and the federal legislation that authorized the creation of the commission, or authorized the two states to enter into the compact and form the commission. That means that in order for the Oregon legislature to have some meaningful input on the functions of the Gorge Commission, which you really don't have at this point, you need to make amendments to the compact. And amendments to the compact would require joint legislation between the states of Washington and Oregon, and that's what we're proposing. There are a number of deficiencies in the compact. The compact, you can find the compact itself in 196-150. ORS 196-150 is where the compact is located. There are a series of deficiencies in the compact. For example, it doesn't contain a termination clause. So there's nothing in the compact itself that spells out how Washington and Oregon, should the two states decide at some point that they no longer want to retain the commission. There's nothing in the compact that specifies how each state acts or what's required of the two states to terminate the compact. There's no forum provisions in the compact, such that if I want to sue the Gorge Commission, there's nothing in the compact that sets out any procedures on how I do it or specifies where I'm supposed to do it. Do I sue them in Washington? Do I sue them in Oregon? As a result, you have essentially forum shopping. If I'm a property, or if I'm a litigant and I want to sue the Gorge Commission, I can choose to sue them in Washington or Oregon, and I'll pick whichever court I think gives me the best opportunity of success. And so those basic provisions that you would find in just about any other contract that you would draft are absent in the compact, and we think need to be discussed and updated. The compact's 25 years old. It's time to take a look at making changes to it and updating it in a way, from our perspective, in a way that gives the Washington and Oregon legislatures some additional policy-making authority over the management plan. You don't have that now. This agency affects thousands of acres of private property within both Oregon and Washington, and policy-making decisions on that private property, we believe, the legislature ought to have at least some authority over those policy-making decisions. So what we're proposing, and I don't, the House Ag Committee, since what brought brought me here originally was a farm-related issue. I thought the House Ag Committee would be an appropriate committee to do this. What we're proposing is that is some outreach between this committee and your counterparts on the Washington side. The Washington House Ag Committee maybe arrange a meeting or two during the interim in the summertime to see if there's a mutual interest from your counterparts over on the Washington side, and an effort then can be made to discuss the compact, look at the specific terms of the compact, what needs to be added, what needs to be changed, to see if joint legislation could be prepared for the 13 session. The only way you can amend the compact would be for the states of Oregon and Washington to both adopt identical legislation making those changes. But just like any other contract, if the two parties to the contract want to change it, they have the ability to do that. And so that's the roadmap that we would hope that this committee would take. We think it's overdue and an important topic and something that would guarantee from an agricultural standpoint that what we would hope is that farmers in the subject to the NSA are treated the same way that farmers in the rest of the state are treated.
Great. Richard.
Thank you, Co-Chair Clem and Co-Chair Esquivel. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resource Advisor. I always enjoy coming up here and testifying with my friend, Mr. Honeycutt. We've worked together on many issues over the years, and I think we've started a discussion about this issue that we're very happy to continue with Mr. Honeycutt. That said, I think the fundamental underlying problem here is not one of the compact or the management plan. The fundamental problem is implementation of the Gorge Act and implementation of the management plan over time. There are mechanisms for amendment of the management plan. The amendment process is controlled by the Gorge Commission itself, which is appointed by a mixture of Oregon and Washington and the counties that make up the scenic area. So there is political oversight over the Gorge Commission, and there is an amendment process to adapt the management plan over time to address issues. The problem we have, frankly, is a resource problem. The two states have, in my personal view, not adequately funded the Gorge Commission for it to be able to take care of these types of problems. And in order for the system to work, the states do need to provide some level of investment into the organization so that it can respond to these types of issues. On your side, in terms of state land use policy, every session, in my memory, you have amended the definition of what can be done on exclusive farm use zone land, what can be done conditionally. There are usually a couple to as many as five or six changes in every session. So inevitably, there is creep in state legislative policy in terms of what we allow on our farmlands. And over time, if the Gorge Management Plan is not looked at to see how it lines up with state policy, you have the potential for more and more differences. So having some sort of process review of the management plan and making a decision about whether it should be amended to be more in line with the state policy and the rest of the state, that mechanism exists right now in the compact and under the management plan. It's simply a matter of getting the right people on the commission and getting the resources for that system to work. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Two Gorge members here, too, you notice. They stayed. Representative Vice Chair
Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's interesting, you know, we are at the 25th anniversary of the scenic area, and And obviously, you know, it's a lot of water under the bridge, so to speak, but also a lot of changes in some of those communities. You know, those are not the same gorge communities that they were in 1986, I can say. You know, Hood River obviously has changed dramatically, and you go down the gorge to the east, the Dalles has certainly experienced a lot of growth and vitality and so forth, too. So one of the issues, obviously, we have is that, you know, we run into issues of needing to have greater access to more land for development, for homes, for schools, for all the above, and we run into those barriers called the urban growth boundaries that can make that very difficult. So is this a time, as we talk about modifying the compact or having a periodic review, if you will, is it potentially conceivable that urban growth boundaries could, the modifications or expansions at that policy could be looked at, and there could be something put into place that might allow for communities to have a greater opportunity or more likely opportunity to actually have some modifications of that? Because, as you well know, it's a big issue in some parts of the area right now. The Dalles, I know, would love to have more land available for their purposes and so forth. And a couple of years ago, I was on the school board in Hood River County, and we were looking for a place to put a new school because we need space, and there wasn't, within our UGB, there was not contiguous acreage enough to site that until the economy led to the downfall of a subdivision that had been platted for development that suddenly was available at a very attractive price. But if that hadn't occurred, we still would be looking for land to build a new school. And we ran into all kinds of barriers just trying to build contiguous to expand the UGB, basically, just to go around the outline of the piece of parcel you're trying to purchase and build a school. So there's a lot of real issues. As these communities grow, they're dynamic, and they need to have the ability to have those services and those facilities that contribute to the health and well-being of those communities. So any comments you have would be helpful.
If I could, Co-Chairs Clem and Esquivel, Representative Johnson, your question about the expansion of the urban areas is timely. The state has been working with urban areas on the Oregon side, and particularly the Dalles, for since I think 2006 or 2007,
yeah.
Dealing with the urban area boundary for the Dalles. And it's a very difficult issue. The reason that it's a very difficult issue is that there is specific language in the Federal Scenic Area Act that allows amendments to urban areas, but it only allows minor amendments to urban areas. The Gorge Commission has worked hard to try and flesh out what minor amendment might mean, but frankly, again, they've run out of resources to explore the boundaries of what might be possible there in terms of an amendment to the Dalles urban area boundary. The state, Oregon, Department of Land Conservation and Development has provided funding to the city of the Dalles to look at an urban area expansion, to survey cultural resources and other constraints that there may be on that urban area expansion. And the city of the Dalles is still working through those issues at the local level. But the Dalles is a very difficult situation because of the constraint in federal legislation and because of the physical geography of the Dalles. You've got the Dalles sitting in that bowl, bounded by very difficult topography and agricultural lands, and also sitting right next to what is probably one of the richest cultural areas for Native Americans in that part of the Northwest. So we're trying to work through those issues. I think ultimately it is going to take some money to work with the city to both look at opportunities for expansion, perhaps in some creative ways that haven't been looked at before, but frankly also for the city to make as efficient use of lands already within the city as possible. So we're working on all those fronts with the city to try to work through that. But the point I really want to make is changing the compact, even if the two states were to agree on that, this would take an act of Congress. Assuming you want to go beyond the minor boundary expansion. So it's a big lift.
Okay, well, we wanted to get the conversation started. We've done that. We've run 20 minutes past when the committee is supposed to be over, so I assume some of us have other meetings.
Yeah,
I know my staff keeps texting me. Thank you
for
coming. Before I drop the gavel, I just wanted to
Jim left, but I want to put one thing on the record. We got an email in response to something that got talked about a little bit ago. There has been some confusion about whether the Wolf Compensation Fund was affected by whatever they called it, the reduction list. Essentially, when all agencies were being told stop, freeze, don't make any more hires, don't make any more things, there were some people wondering whether that affected. It does not. Does not affect it. It's not on hold. There were some news articles that made it sound like it was on hold. It's not on hold.
If I remember right, we allocated like $500,000 toward that project as well, did we not?
What was it? 100,000. So right now, counties are in the process of applying for, there's rules being established, and the counties are applying in the next basically 20 days, and then funds would potentially be started giving out in March. So people should not, that's not frozen. The bill already speaks to how to deal with that, which is you reduce from your tax credit anything you got out of that fund, but I just want to make sure people knew they should not stop looking to apply to that fund if they have depredation. Those for listening on the radio audience here.
Yeah.
With that, thank you for your attention. Sorry about my bad time management, folks.
Yeah, ma'am. You're
Really quickly, just a heads up, I'm going to set up an appointment to speak with the two of you.